call the meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. I just want to point out lots of folks interested in this subject, and glad to see you here on this hard-to-travel day. I just want to point out that after your in your packet, after the agenda, you will find an outline of the state laws relating to recycling, and that was done by our able counsel, and I appreciate that. Thank you. But that's just for your information as we go through our agenda today. With that...
Yes, I'd like to move approval of the December 9th, 2013 meeting minutes.
Thank you. I don't see any questions or opposition. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. So with that, we will begin, and we will have Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kadelka from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name's Kirk Kadelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I will be doing very little of the talking today on the MPCA part of the presentation. My colleague, Peter Sandai, and Colleen Hetzel, who will be up here in a moment, will be doing most of the speaking today. We just wanted to start off and give a little bit of an overview, a brief history of the solid waste management in the state. Current status of solid waste management with some numbers for you to have as you continue through today's hearing and talk about a number of aspects of recycling and composting. And then I'm going to turn it over to Peter to talk about what's in our garbage, our waste composition study, to see what is being thrown away in the trash. And then finally, Colleen will talk about waste reuse and reduction, one of the first priorities dealing with our garbage, and then have questions. So just briefly, these are some pictures of how solid waste was handled prior to the 1960s. In Minnesota, it was indiscriminately dumped or buried, and in Minnesota, favorite locations seem to be low areas, abandoned gravel pits or wetlands. And in these areas, a majority of the waste passed through with water and the like and started to create drinking water problems. And so we have a groundwater contamination problem from waste disposal that dates prior to the 1970s. So then with the creation of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in 1967 and later, the agency put together solid waste disposal rules in the 1970s where we consolidated and moved away from the 15,000 plus dumps across the state to about 140 permitted sanitary landfills that could be controlled and managed in a way that would help protect the environment and public health. This was also aided by passage of federal legislation later on. So this is the first part of our history with solid waste. In the 1980s, we started to see a shift where we started looking at not only how we properly handle the disposal of the materials, but reducing what's disposed of. And we have a number of dates at this point that come into play. In 1980, the Waste Management Act is established, which creates a state's priorities for handling waste, often referred to as the solid waste hierarchy, which shows that we should be using waste in a way that we reduce, reuse, recycle, and composting before we get to the decision of whether it should go to waste energy or landfilling. At the same time, the legislature put together the Metropolitan Landfill Abatement Act in 1984, which really does set the metropolitan area on a path to move away from landfilling and, again, move us higher up in those priorities of recycling and composting and even waste energy. And then in 1989, the Governor's Select Committee on Recycling and Environment, often referred to as SCORE, made a number of recommendations, which sets out laws and also funding sources to help with the recycling programs. So as a state, you see us moving from how do we deal with the trash and the garbage that we create and make sure we're handling it correctly when it's disposed of, to being proactive, looking at recycling and composting and reduction. And that's what we've are put together as a national leader because of this integrated waste management system. You see a number of pictures here of the various types of way we handle our waste. So for your consideration for the rest of the day, we did want to map out what that has meant in Minnesota. So this chart that you'll see up on the screens is from 1991 through 2012 on how we handle waste. You see a number of factors here. Every 10 years, we also have the percentages of recycling, organics management, composting, waste to energy, and landfilling, and also the amount of tons. During that time, you can see a large amount of increase in landfilling, increase to some degree in amount to recycling, but the percentages on recycling, while growing a little bit, it's not the growth that we would like. We're a national leader, but we can do much more. And then you also see the staying the same there for organics collection and a reduction in waste energy. So that's where we've been and where we are today. But I think the question that the committee chair and the folks that will be testifying today is, where do we want to be in the future? And this is one possibility. This is from our Metropolitan Solid Waste Policy Plan, which sets out goals for 2030 for the metropolitan area about how we would like to see waste handled. And as you can see there, a combined of 60% recycling and 15% for compostable, that's 75% of our garbage would never touch a landfill, and the materials will be used and added benefit to in the system. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Peter.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Santai with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm a principal planner in solid waste area. Thank you for having us here today to speak. So this past year, the agency conducted a waste composition study, which is essentially a study of what's still in the garbage after all of our diversion efforts have taken place. So this is after the recyclables have been pulled out, after the composting has taken place. So this is what's happening, what people are actually discarding in the garbage. We did a sort, separated out that garbage into 50 different material types. And it's important to note that we did it by material type, not by the method in which that material would be handled if it were diverted. And I'll show you the importance of that in a few slides. And the report is available here on this at this link. So here are the material categories, and I'm not going to go into specific detail on all of these because it's far too much to discuss today. But there were 9 paper categories. Among those, newspaper, you know, common paper categories that you think of, cardboard, also includes aseptic containers like your juice boxes. 11 plastics categories, 4 metals categories, 3 glass categories, 6 different organics categories, which include food waste, yard waste, wood waste, compostable plastics, and then there were 5 other waste categories, which are detailed here, 6 HHW categories, 5 different electronics categories, and 1 was just kind of an other category. I wanted to dive into a little more detail on the paper and plastics categories. And you'll see that I don't have it separated out here at 9 categories for the paper. But of those categories, 12.3% of the paper that was sorted falls into the recyclable paper category. And that equates to roughly 361,000 tons generated in the state each year. Almost 10% of that paper category is compostable, so if it's not recyclable, it's frequently compostable. And only 2.3% of that overall paper tonnage is non-compostable or non-recyclable. And 24.5% of the total garbage generated is in this paper category. Of the plastic, generalizing a little bit, roughly half of it's recyclable and half of it's not. You can see that a little bit more of it than half is recyclable plastic. But roughly 281,000 tons of recyclable plastic is discarded every year. Of the major material categories, metal is 4.5% of the waste stream. The one I want to highlight here is organics, is 31% of the waste stream. If you add that to the compostable paper category, which you're looking at roughly 40% of the garbage that's thrown away is compostable material. So that's a pretty significant portion of the waste stream. But you can still see that these common recyclable materials that we work on recycling daily are still showing up here in pretty big quantities. The metal, there's still 130,000 tons of metal in the garbage. Glass, electronics, and then two that are just worth noting because they've had some attention here at the Capitol, carpet and mattresses have come up in the past, so I thought it was worth highlighting those items for you as well. So what's worth noting is this is the first waste composition study since 2000 that the state has conducted. And the material categories were sorted in a way so that we could compare them to the previous results and see how the waste composition has changed over time. And the three that are highlighted here are the ones that are statistically different than 2000. So as you can see, the amount of paper in the waste stream has decreased roughly 10%. The amount of plastic has increased by about 6%. And the organic materials has increased from 25 to 31%. So we are seeing a difference in the way that, in the waste that's being generated, which also affects our ability to divert that material. Those are things that we need to consider in terms of maximizing diversion from landfilling. So with all that material in the waste stream, it's important to note that there are still a significant number of opportunities to help us get to the 75% that Kirk noted. One is that the compost rule that the agency has been working on is currently out on dual notice and is accepting public comments until March 7th. But it's anticipated that once that compost rule is complete, it should help facilitate the development of additional compost facilities in the state. There's a significant amount of recyclable material in the waste stream that's valued at about $210 million. And in order to get to these very aggressive 75% goals, a number of significant policies would need to be put into place to change the system from what it is today. And some of those ideas are highlighted in both the most recent Metro Area Solid Waste Policy Plan, as well as the 2011 solid waste policy report that the agency developed for the legislature. So with that, I think we can open it up for questions on my section. Otherwise, I will hand off to Colleen Hetzel for the next section.
I don't see any questions. I'm sure they'll come later.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Chair and Committee members. My name is Colleen Hetzel, and I am a Principal Planner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
We're going to need you to move a little closer to the mic. Thanks.
Today, I will be providing you with an update on the agency's waste reduction activities and opportunities for the future. As has been illustrated in previous slides, solid waste management has made large strides over the past 30 years. The old question of where will our trash go has segued into how can I prevent waste from being generated in the first place. Resources are becoming scarce, and government and businesses alike will need to use resources as efficiently as possible. According to a survey recently completed by KPMG Advisory Services, securing long-term supply costs efficiently and sustainably is becoming a business-wide concern. 63% of firms expect to face supply risk within 5 years, and 96% of firms expect significant or moderate impact on business performance from scarcity. Waste reduction focuses on reducing the upfront impacts and needs for raw materials that are used in manufacturing. Waste reduction not only reduces raw material consumption, but also reduces the need for further transportation and end-of-life management. These large environmental savings is why waste reduction is so important. Reducing the upstream environmental impact shows much larger environmental benefits than end-of-life management. Over the last 2 years, the PCA has begun working with businesses and government on waste reduction and resource conservation through two activities, government purchasing efficiencies and supporting the state's vibrant reuse, rental, and repair community. Reuse and environmental preferable purchasing were chosen because the state can make an impact on upstream reduction of waste instead of trying to make changes to the system at the end of the life. In late 2011, the agency commissioned a study on the economic activities of the reuse community in Minnesota. The intent of this unique study was to determine what impact reuse has on the state's economy. The focus was strictly on economics, not on environmental benefits. Some of the highlights from this study were that the Minnesota reuse sector directly employs almost 46,000 people and generates at least $4 billion in gross sales annually. That is close to 2% of the state's gross domestic product and employment base. Those 46,000 direct jobs also generate an additional 4,600 jobs in other sectors. Reuse companies also tend to be small, locally owned and operated, providing local jobs and increased capital retention to our community. As part of the study, economists from both the University of Minnesota and other areas of the nation considered to be experts on this topic were interviewed for their comments on the report. One comment they all had is that a dollar is a dollar to the macroeconomy. However, several of them pointed out that a dollar spent in the local community has a bigger impact when it comes from services in the reuse, repair, or rental community, because those are dollars that are coming from service industries. And service industries tend to have a larger percentage of the dollar that is given back to the community. Although our study did not focus on environmental impacts, one of the added benefits of our study was that some thrift stores were able to share information with us. One thrift store was able to provide us with 1 year of sales data for their reused clothing. This sales data allowed the agency to run reused clothing through a life cycle analysis input-output model. The data from just this one store and 1 year sale of reused clothing was able to show the environmental benefits of saving 1,500 to 5,500 metric tons of carbon dioxide. These savings can all be attributed to the upstream avoidance of needing to manufacture new clothing. You would not get these large savings just from the end-of-life management from such a small portion. Since the economic study focused on the economic benefits of the reuse center, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is now focusing on collaborative, voluntary approach with the reuse community to standardize measurement and quantify the environmental benefits of reuse. A new trade association called Reuse Minnesota has been established and will look at obtaining environmental measurements as well as providing networking opportunities for reuse businesses. The trade association launched in June 2013, and membership is steadily growing. Since the launch, many members of the reuse industry have been pleased to find that they are able to partner with other reuse organizations to increase the number of commodities that they can accept in their stores. These partnerships have increased trades between organizations, leading to higher sales and new customers. These partnerships can also lead to new endeavors, such as the university's Pack and Give Back program. The Pack and Give Back program is a collaboration between the university, some nonprofits, and government entities. And basically, it is a pilot project that happened this last summer where when students move out from the university off-campus housing, they are able to put out at curb for collection household items that they had been throwing away but now are instead putting out for reuse. It was a huge success, and over 30,000 pounds of material were diverted for reuse for the students instead of thrown into the landfill. The other waste reduction activity that the agency is working on is government procurement. Purchasing can be a big consumption method, and therefore can have an impact along the entire life cycle of the product, from raw materials acquisition through manufacturing, product transportation, use, and the product's disposal. Buying is what drives upstream impacts, and buying is also what leads to the waste generation. Based on a study done by the state of Oregon, state and local government in Oregon is responsible for 13% of the final demand of consumption in the state. The PCA has not done a similar calculation for Minnesota. However, this analysis and other studies convinced the PCA that a focus on reduction of environmental impacts from our purchasing was worthwhile. As part of an EPA grant, the agency expanded the long-term focus of purchasing from office supplies and office paper to include top impact purchasing categories such as fuel, information communication technologies, food, and construction. All of these commodities have high climate ecosystem quality, resource depletion, and water consumption impacts. We can now look at not just a single attribute such as recycled content, but can write better environmental specifications based on much more sophisticated understanding of what parts of product or service carry the biggest environmental impacts. Another portion of the EPA grant that the state worked on was a pilot project with two state agencies. They were testing the replacement of single-use corrugated cardboard boxes with plastic reusable totes. The plastic reusable totes could be used up to 100 times, whereas the corrugated shipping boxes were single-use items. The pilot showed that if this was implemented to all state agencies, 52 metric tons of corrugated waste could be avoided. Finally, the agency will continue to work on supporting the reuse sector, specifically establishing a measurement tool that will allow us to capture the environmental benefits that are occurring. We will promote collaboration within the reuse industry and work to establish government-business partnerships. The agency has learned a lot about the state's purchasing and will continue to work on adding environmental language to state contracts whenever possible. The agency will also work with the Department of Administration on developing measurement for specific contracts whenever possible. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, I do just have a, I think, a fairly simple question. You caught my attention with the reusable totes versus cardboard, corrugated cardboard packing boxes. The ratio of use certainly is simple to follow. What about the source of that material, recycling cardboard as opposed to the petroleum products to create the plastic containers? What's the measure and weight of those issues?
Chair, committee members, to answer that question, the corrugated cardboard boxes and the plastic totes were put through a life cycle analysis environmental benefit calculator. And over the course of the life and end of life of those materials, the plastic totes would be better, even with the petroleum and other raw materials needed to create those, because they are used so many times as opposed to the corrugated cardboard, which was being recycled after only one use.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, or maybe it's for Commissioner Kudelka, but I was just wondering, are we going to have any discussion? I know it's just in draft form, but the study that's being brought forward, I just had a couple of questions that I wanted to just get on the record for the Assistant Commissioner.
On the bottles?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I think we're going to have an opportunity for that later on, but let him...
I was looking at the agenda and I wasn't sure. I'm just wondering, Assistant Commissioner, I know in the earlier meeting today that I was at, there was much discussion about how it's listed as a cost in the draft, that the cost of operating the system is $29 million, and that's actually the shortfall. The real cost to implementing that system is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And do you know, is it the intent to actually list that as the real cost? That's my one question. Then I had a second unrelated question.
Madam Chair and committee members, we are still, the report that we're talking about is the Beverage Container Recycling Refund Program report that the legislature requested us to have put together. And one aspect of it that Representative McNamara is talking about is our cost-benefit analysis that we had an independent third party partake in, and we put together that draft piece. Earlier today we had a public meeting where we had an opportunity to present that to interested folks, and we did take feedback, and that was one of the items that were asked. We are still going to come back and see what feedback we are. We are still making changes to the report. The report is not complete. It's still a couple weeks out yet. We're still letting for public comment in for another week, so written comments to us for us to be able to finalize our report. I don't know how the end is going to be done. We have taken that into consideration. I don't know what the final report is going to look like at this point. I think also some folks, the media have jumped on at that number also as being the cost, so we'll keep that in mind when we do the final report.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I had one more. I was glad you put it in one of your handouts because I didn't remember. In statute in 115A95, I'm going to read. You've got a couple. It's just a long sentence. Recyclable materials must be delivered to the appropriate materials processing facility as outlined in rules of the agency or any other facility permitted to recycle or compost the materials. Commissioner, I read that, and I've been a fan that it should be illegal to put recyclables in the garbage. I think it actually is in Minnesota law today. When I read that, it looks to me like we probably have what we need to remind people that they should be putting it. We just don't have. Commissioner, you don't even need to look beyond this room. There's four garbage cans that I can see in this room. There is not a recycling in this room. We have no standardization, not only in the state office building where we legislate and tell people what to do, more or less in the gas stations on the street. Is it illegal to put garbage, or is it illegal to put recyclables in garbage today?
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm going to look for some help here too, but my understanding is the way that this is written is if you set out recyclable materials on your curb and its intent is to be recycled, someone can't pick them up, a hauler, and then bring it to a landfill. They have to manage it in the proper way. It does not prevent me, though, from taking a piece of paper and putting it into the garbage. That's the difference on this. We do agree that better standardization, and there are more efforts that need to be done to increase the recycling opportunities for Minnesotans.
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner, I think that you, and I'll be glad to work with you. I usually don't like helping agencies write rules, but it looks to me like you could write a rule that we could get some standardization and actually have, when you go to the gas station, have a recycling bin next to the garbage, because you're not supposed to put recyclings in the garbage. It says it right here. You're not supposed to do that. I think you just got to adopt some rules, and we need to fix this situation. So this is a good discussion to have, because we have an opportunity in Minnesota to lead, and it looks like somebody long before you and I came around thought this was the right thing to do. So I look forward to working with you to do the common sense thing instead of some 1970-ish bees in the bottles in the corner of the grocery store or the garage or apartment building or wherever it is. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara, I think what you have brought up is something that maybe during session we can have a hearing on, because I also see requiring counties to offer recycling programs under that. PCA encourages but does not require recycling by commercial and industrial businesses. So as we read all of our statutes together, I think there is room for interpretation, but I think that's an excellent discussion point, and we will make sure that we have a time to do that sometime during session. Is that satisfactory?
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's important for people to know that one-third of the garbage is generated away from the home,
yes,
and we do nothing. It's embarrassing. It's absolutely embarrassing at the workplace, led by this building and the really neat one across the street that we're refurbishing. I'm sorry, I hate to use the word, but it's a joke, the system we have. I'm not the only one that's picking the cans out of those all the time, and I've been arguing it for 12 years, and we don't change. And if we don't change, how in the world do you think they're changing in Hastings or Rosso?
We are going to follow up on some understanding of the law later on, because we obviously have some big gaps. But as we are talking about gaps, let me go back on that. You're page 3, and you have goals for the Twin Cities. Are there similar stretch goals for either outstate Minnesota or for some of our regional centers?
Madam Chair and committee members, that's an excellent question. In statute, the agency is required to do a plan for the metropolitan area, and this is part of it. There is not a similar outstate Minnesota planning exercise being done, although we work with counties on local county plans, and we are increasingly working with outstate counties on regionalization to gain efficiencies and to do some of this work. But there isn't necessarily a PCA or state set out goal for this. The handout by House Research does note what's in statute, but that's the only other goal at this point. We don't have a report with a similar goal number, but it is something that we are looking to work on.
Just my understanding outstate, we probably need to separate those goals between regional centers, big areas, and areas that are sparsely populated. We tended to lump them together, and that may be a mistake. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kudelka, you said also on page 3, when we looked at the little graph that you had from 91 to 2012, you said that we are a national leader in our recycling efforts here in the state of Minnesota, but you don't have any data here for me. Give me an example. Give us some data that tells us how we are a national leader and how we compare to other states with regards to our recycling efforts.
Madam Chair and committee members, I don't have a comparison of the other state numbers, but we can provide that to you to show those numbers. I just don't have them handy right now.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on page 5, where we were talking about the paper and plastic, to follow up on Representative Ward's question, I'm sorry, I don't remember which one of the two of you made this statement, but you said that, no, I'm sorry, it's not on page 5. I'm sorry, on page 8, the last page, to follow up on Representative Ward's question, comparing the corrugated cardboard to the plastic, and I wrote it down here. The statement that was made talked about the direct damage done by using corrugated as opposed to plastic. Can you quantify for me direct damage?
Madam Chair, committee members. What I was referring to is that if you run both the corrugated cardboard and the plastics through an environmental benefits life cycle analysis calculator, you would be able to get the environmental, different environmental outputs related to water consumption, ecotoxicity, and other environmental benefits to come out of the calculator and tell and to show you what those environmental benefits would be for both of the different product materials that are being run through. So it told the calculator showed that the environmental benefits for reusing the plastic tote are less, or the environmental impacts are less from using the reusing the plastic totes than from the single use corrugated cardboard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about the economic benefits to the state of Minnesota? I'm thinking particularly about the logging industry, the paper industry. We've seen what's happened over the past few years to the logging industry and the paper mills and the corrugated cardboard facilities. What about the economic impact?
Madam Chair, committee members, the calculator does not look at environmental impact at all, so we don't have the answer to that question. It only looked at environmental impacts.
Are there other questions from members? If you would follow up, I think it was Representative Fabian's question about, or whether it was McNamara's, about comparing our recycling rates to others. We will get that around. It's my expectation we'll find that we've been fairly flat and other people have pulled ahead of us, that we were doing well in the 90s, and then we rather leveled off. Is that what we're going to see?
Madam Chair and committee members, I will need to look at the numbers. We can also, it sounds like you'd like a time component too, and we can look at that.
I think that's important. I don't see any other other questions, so we will invite Representative Hornstein to come up. Thank you for this work.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. First of all, I want to thank Chair Wagenius for having this hearing. I think just based on the turnout and some of the media interest, this is a very, very timely set of issues to deal with. And I've already learned a lot, I think, from the PCA presentation. Before you, I decided, based on some of the information that you were just presented by the Pollution Control Agency and talking with other stakeholders, that it would be perhaps helpful to introduce legislation this session to update the state's recycling goals and acknowledge the conclusions that we just heard from the waste composition study, the talk about the significant increase in compostable materials that are in the waste stream. So before I get into some of the concepts of this bill, I just wanted to let you know, Madam Chair and committee members, that this is simply a draft. This bill was not jacketed or introduced last week. It's a work in progress, and I would invite comments not only from the public and stakeholders, but committee members, and what you think works for you or may need to be improved in this bill, so that towards the beginning of the session, the bill can be introduced with as much consensus, or if not consensus, input and feedback from as many people as possible. I think this is a really important issue with where there is a lot of potential for consensus among people who normally may not agree on things to move forward with this important recycling goal. So a couple of the highlights of this legislation, Madam Chair and members, and the rationale for it. First of all, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka mentioned the SCORE goals and the Select Committee on Recycling and Environment. In state statute, we have a goal in the metro area for 50% recycling. This bill increases that goal to 75% and acknowledges composting. Now, for my greater Minnesota colleagues, before you reach for the Alka-Seltzer, this is a metro goal only. We understand that there are challenges and differences in terms of how the metro area and greater Minnesota address issues of recycling. So just to be clear from the outset, this legislation deals with the metro area only. And as you heard in the presentation earlier, the 75% recycling goal, which includes composting, 15% of that compostables will be included in this, and then 60% is recyclable materials. That figure has actually been agreed upon and included in the PCA Metro Area Solid Waste Plan. So this is already a figure that's been studied, that's been evaluated. There's a great degree of stakeholder consensus around that figure. And so this is something that the Pollution Control Agency has put into their Solid Waste Management Plan. It's not just something that's been made up out of thin air. There's a lot of rationale for it, and in fact, we can get there. This simply codifies what you just heard the Pollution Control Agency say, 75% by 2030. And it's important to get this into statute because this actually gives us a goal. It gives us something that we are saying as a state that we take this seriously. We take this increase in recycling and composting seriously enough that we're going to codify it, and then that is going to, in turn, I think, promote the policies that are necessary to get there. We found that success in the renewable energy standard, and in fact, we do have recycling goals codified, as I mentioned, in the SCORE goals, and those are, again, from 1990. So we're talking about almost a quarter century that we are, talk about updating and needing to update laws based on current realities. These are almost 25-year-old recycling goals and standards that are in statute. So it's high time that we get up to date and up to speed with a 21st century recycling goal, again, that the PCA has said is attainable. And so a second feature of this legislation I think is critically important and, again, brings us up to speed with 21st century waste composition is this organics composting element. And when we're talking about 31% of the waste stream being compostable, we'll hear more details about that from Felicity Britton in a few minutes. When we talk about that level of waste that can easily be separated out and composted. This is a huge opportunity for our state in terms of jobs and avoiding the costs of putting these materials inappropriately in landfills and incinerators. We've got to get at that organic stream. We have made some progress in certain communities, but this is really low-hanging fruit in terms of our ability to get these, you know, increased recycling. And so we have a tremendous opportunity in the state to build on some initial success in organics composting, and this bill helps us get there by including organics composting in that 75% goal. I'm not going to go through the bill very specifically, but again, just to sort of mention a couple of the highlights. I mean, the main piece of this is that increased recycling and composting goal, updating it for the realities of the waste stream in the 21st century. But I was intrigued by Representative McNamara's very on-point observation. And as a matter of fact, we attempt to answer the McNamara question, which I'll call it, in the very first section of this bill, where we do have a standardized format for recyclable material containers in public entities. We look at sports facilities and commercial buildings, but, you know, maybe as Representative McNamara pointed out, the state office building should be amended to be part of this. So we get at the fact that we don't have opportunities for recycling in many places, and particularly in the commercial sector. You know, the next section, you know, again addresses the source reduction question that was put on the table by the previous testifier, and I noticed that we haven't looked at that since 1997. This is sort of, you know, a little unsession-ish. We're updating some laws here, but that's not really the goal of this. This isn't part of that material or that effort. And then we get into source-separated compostables being included in the definition of recycling. I think that's critically important. You know, we're talking about primarily food waste, but also paper products that are not currently recycled, soiled pizza boxes, things of that sort. And then a second feature of this bill that I think is critically important is that we are reallocating money that's raised from the SCORE revenue that the state collects. And there is a certain percentage of that, I believe it's 30% members, that goes into the general fund. If we're going to get to the 75%, let's give the counties and public entities some more support so they can get there. That money from the general fund should go to its stated purpose that it was raised for, which is to increase and improve recycling. And I figured out that was the amount of money we're talking about here is 571 thousandths of a percent. So it's a very small part of the general fund. And, you know, we get incredible bang for our buck by diverting that from the general fund to its intended purpose, which is recycling. And I'll simply conclude, you're going to hear more about that from my testifiers, by saying this makes so much economic and environmental sense. It's a win-win all around. We're creating jobs, we're helping the environment, we're cleaning up the air and the water, and then we're also doing a tremendous amount to implement what then-Governor Pawlenty and the legislature wanted us to do in 2007 when the Climate Change Action Group was formed. I know, Madam Chair, you've pointed out many times that solid waste is something we actually have a tremendous amount of control over in the state. And so we can actually make tremendous strides of implementing that original MCAG recommendation, which was 75% recycling and composting, by passing this legislation this year. So, again, we don't want that MCAG report to just sit and collect dust on some bookshelf. This is something that came up yesterday. There was a gathering from the Minnesota Environmental Initiative, and a number of questions were asked about how do we actually implement this wonderful report that was produced on a bipartisan basis in 2007. So this is a comprehensive update of our solid waste policy. It'll increase recycling and composting in a very realistic and doable way. It'll create jobs. It'll help the environment. And I think it's a win-win all around, Madam Chair.
Are there? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, I think you missed subdivision 8. I'm just wondering, is that dealing with the problem that we have with the metro waste going outside the 7-county metropolitan area? Is that your efforts to try and change that situation?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, yes. As I was sitting down with various stakeholders and trying to figure out, it's one thing to set out this this goal. It's ambitious but doable, as I said. We got to have some money to do it. And so we took a look at some existing statutes around how we fund recycling in the state and looked through some loopholes. And I think there is a loophole here in terms of this particular section that we're trying to close. It will, I don't know the exact number. Maybe Mr. Eliff could shed some light on it. But we will get some money intended for this purpose captured through Subdivision 8. I know, Mr. Eliff, if you want to shed a little bit more light on that.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Eliff wants to. It looked like the author wanted a number. That wasn't where I was going.
Madam Chair, I don't have a number, but it, as Representative Hornstein says, this is closing a loophole. The Subdivision 8 that you referred to, Representative McNamara, establishes an account for this fee that is not now charged on waste that is processed outside the metro area to go into to be used for various county recycling purposes. But I don't know exactly how much that will raise.
Representative Hornstein, Representative McNamara, I'm going to ask our fiscal person to help us out, to give us the big, broader context about where the waste fee goes. If you'd,
Madam Chair, as I think what you're looking for is part of the third page of the bill, where we're talking about 70% is currently allocated to the environmental fund, and then the 30% is currently going to the general fund. And over the last few years, that's roughly $70 million per year total from solid waste tax, of which 20 is going to the general fund, and roughly $50 million would be going to the environmental fund. Is that what you're looking for, Madam Chair?
That would be it. So when we did our budget this last year, so when I'm talking about on a biennial basis now, $100 million of the solid waste tax overall went to PCA for their budget. Of that, then $30 million went directly out for SCORE. So there's I think it, when you're thinking about this, think of it in three pieces. The money that goes into the general fund, the money that goes to PCA, and of that money that goes to PCA, what goes directly back out to counties. Does that help a bit?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just bringing it up because I don't think other folks might not have known what also was in Representative Hornstein's bill. Because what you're doing is trying to find a solution, Representative Hornstein, to what actually the Pollution Control Commissioner is supposed to be doing now, and that's make sure that your burner next to the Twin Stadium is being utilized fully and not going to metro or non-metro landfills. Unfortunately, we can't seem to find a compromise, and I appreciate you making an effort to try and correct that. But there will be winners and losers in what you're doing here, and it's a discussion. I just wanted to bring it up that it's in the bill, and I think if we do hear the bill, it's really an unrelated thing to the composting. I like composting. This mess, good luck if you find a solution to it.
Well, I'm sure that's not, I mean, that's not the intent here isn't to add waste to the incinerator. What we have to do here is to make sure that incinerators and landfills are not burning or burying recyclables and compostables. And, you know, there is a lot of waste that's leaving the metro area, but the issue is that we need to gather money so that that waste is recycled and composted and not sent to facilities that are lower on the hierarchy. This is, Representative McNamara, Madam Chair, and members, this is a draft. And so if Subdivision 8 is problematic for people, You know, we can delete that, but I want to know how much. We're going to find out in the next few weeks how much money is on the table here that can be generated through this subdivision for the purposes of recycling and composting. And that's why this is in here. I think the provision for funding that's far more important is the one that Representative Wagenius has described, which is capturing that SCORE money, which is, you know, again, it's one of these things where we're collecting money for an intended purpose, and it's not going fully to that purpose, and I find that to be troubling.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is along that same line as Representative McNamara's questions. You say this bill, I don't know if you mean entirely, Representative Hornstein, is just for the metro area, but I've had a concern expressed to me outstate about what the SCORE fund reallocation would do to our waste-to-energy facility back in my area. Could you comment on that? Will there be money going to different places or less money going to waste-to-energy in the SCORE allocation?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, my understanding, and we could have others that have a little bit more expertise here, is that the SCORE money is collected and then sent back to counties for the purposes of recycling. So, you know, that's straightforward, and I don't think that this bill is silent on who gets the money in terms of how it's reallocated. Now, obviously, some metro counties will receive an increase because there's more money going, you know, into the system. But I would imagine some of the greater Minnesota counties may receive a little bit of a bump in their funding for the purposes of recycling and composting. So this is not, and I'm glad you asked the question, Representative Anderson, because this is not saying we're going to collect this extra money and then redistribute it to the metro only. That is not the intention. That's not the case here.
We will find that base number that you're talking about. That seems somewhat odd to me, so we will before we have another hearing on that, we will check up on those numbers.
And Madam Chair, just to reiterate, it's not my intention to take money collected statewide for the purposes of SCORE and then specifically reallocate it to the metro area. That is not in the cards here.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, Representative Hornstein, you don't want the opposite either, correct?
Correct. And there's a form, Madam Chair, I understand there's a formula for all of this that the PCA, I guess, will let you know about.
We will be working on that between now and next hearing that we would have on this. I don't see any other questions from members, so if you would like to bring up Eureka Recycling, and you're going to be sticking with us this afternoon?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. All right. If Tim Brownell and Susan Hubbard, are you coming up together? It's not necessary, but if that's the case, we'd be glad to have you that way. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Tim Brownell. I'm CEO of Eureka Recycling, and with me is Susan Hubbard, my predecessor at CEO at Eureka and co-founder of the organization, and now does a lot of work on behalf of Eureka. Eureka is a 501c3 nonprofit organization based here in the Twin Cities that's providing zero waste collection and advocacy services. We do that through recycling collection services in the city of St. Paul and other communities in Ramsey County. We operate the Twin Cities Free Market, which is an online reuse exchange, which is used by 1 in 9 metropolitan residents. We provide recycling composting services in Minneapolis. We do workshops on preventing wasted food and backyard composting. And we also operate a MRF, a material recovery facility, where recyclables are sorted and prepared for market. Eureka is currently employing about 100 employees, including a union recycling collection fleet.
Thank you. And we wanted to talk a little bit about that recycling rate, that there are some questions about that 41%. And we've been resting on the laurels of that 41% and talking about being a leader in recycling for a very long time, but it's been a while really since we've been a leader in recycling. That 41% we were leading in maybe in 1995, but since that time, certainly we've been surpassed by cities like in Portland and San Francisco and the state of Washington and the state of Oregon, where they have surpassed the percentages that we're at now when we were leading with them. So we know, the good news is that we know there is a way to get off this mark of 41% that we've been at for a very long time, and I think that's been since about 1995. And the proof that we can do that is that we have a tremendous interest from people and all kinds of surveys now that are showing that more than ever people want to recycle and they want to recycle more materials. There's national surveys, a 2013 survey that said 82% of Americans feel a sense of pride when they recycle. There's St. Paul's recent survey that said 96% of residents already participate in recycling and want to recycle more. And when it gets to organics, Ramsey County just did a survey that said 76% of residents say that they'd be willing to separate their organic waste for composting, and the majority of those people were willing to pay extra to do that. So we know that there's a lot of room for improvement, and we look at how can we get off of this point where we're disposing of a million tons of recyclables and a million tons of compostables every year. And I think that Representative Hornstein is right, is that we need new visionary goals. We haven't revisited goals in 25 years. And we haven't, that means that there's no real direction from the top that says we need to move, and the time is now. In addition to that, I think, of course, it makes sense that we need to allocate resources to that to make it happen. It's not just the goals, though. Now we actually have valid waste composition data, which we haven't had for a very long time, that looks where the gains are to be had. And I think we've heard from folks already that, no, it's away from home. We're missing a huge amount of material away from home, and we're not directing any resources there to get it. The other big thing is composting. And we're going to need the leadership that we had in this state on recycling if we're going to get that compostable material out of the trash, where it's costing us a fortune and it's creating a huge environmental problem. So now, with this data, we know exactly where to direct the resources for the biggest gain. And now, in an interesting turn of events, we have producers, brands, for that matter, that are interested in recycling now, that realize that they need to step into the game of recycling, partially because they want to get the raw materials back so they can package and make their products. But also, we have to give them credit that we know that those are human beings in those organizations, and those human beings care about the environment. And so now let's get those producers, while they're interested in getting that material back, let's get them to step up to the plate and pay for some of this, because we can't get it all from SCORE. SCORE isn't going to pay for everything that we need to get done. And then finally, I think it's really true that the subsidies that we've had for wasting need to stop. Very simply, even in Ramsey County, I think Ramsey County's share of subsidy for incineration this year is $8 million. And it's been, they've put over $220 million into incineration subsidies over the past 27 years. That $220 million sure could go a long way to getting those organics out of the waste stream. And there's a huge opportunity there, and resources that we haven't even looked at that are beyond the state, the state's current budget.
So I wanted to show you a snapshot of what the MPCA put together, a policy report in 2011 that talked about some of the jobs and economic benefits of recycling in the state of Minnesota. And as you can see in the highlighted bubbles, there's roughly 37,000 jobs created in the state of Minnesota directly and indirectly through the recycling activities that are currently going on. That's brought roughly $272 million in revenues, tax revenues, to the state of Minnesota based on the MPCA's own report. So you can see the potential of, as we increase these goals and we look to expand recovery within recycling and within composting, the economic benefit is there. So this isn't just an exercise in how do we move materials out of garbage cans into recycling containers. There's huge benefit to the state in a number of ways, and this is a demonstration of the economic benefit. What the Institute of Local Self-Reliance, an organization based out of Washington, D.C., and an office here in the Twin Cities, their findings have demonstrated that for every ton of material that's moved into the recycling stream as opposed to disposed of, creates 10 times as many jobs. So a job for every 10 jobs for every 10,000 tons. There's also the environmental benefits of moving these materials into these goals, and as Representative Hornstein was reflecting earlier, the bill that he's bringing forward represents goals that were brought forward and roughly reflect what were brought forward in the MCAG study in 2008. And in that, you can see that the third highest means by which we can reduce greenhouse gas generation in the state of Minnesota or its impact nationally and globally is through achieving these goals. This is the third most impactful way that the state can do this. And those goals were a 60% recycling rate and a 15% composting rate.
And in addition to that, in the MCAG goals, which I think is really important and is also reflected in Representative Hornstein's bill, is the source reduction goal. Because without source reduction, what happens is that while we continue to recycle more, so people think, all right, we're at 41% and we're not recycling anymore. But what's happened is actually that, so for example, from I think it was 1995 to 1999, we actually had a 14% increase in the amount of tons of material recycled. But at the very same time, we had a 14.6% increase in the amount of waste that we generated. So without stopping the increased generation of waste and, in fact, rolling it back, we're not going to get the gains that are predicted environmentally. And besides being the greatest gains through prevention, it is also the cheapest way for us to deal with this problem. And yet we have not allocated 1/1,000th of a percent of the money that we've allocated to disposal, let alone recycling and composting and everything else combined, to any efforts involving source reduction, really reducing waste at the source. And so just for example to that, in learning from the past, when we're looking now at setting these goals, we really need to look at the source reduction goal. It's critical for us to look at it, but it's also critical for us to fund it. And perhaps some of the money that would come from these different sources that we've just talked about would be earmarked specifically for source reduction, where there's the biggest bang for the buck.
So when we look at the success of the initial investments and goals for recycling, we've reached a 41% recovery rate. We really want to look as we look forward and say, how are we going to capture the next 35%? Is take a look at how were we successful there. And a big piece of that when we look at recycling was we did did a lot of work on source reduction and prevention. Felicity will be speaking after us around the benefits of composting, but there's one thing that we did want to point out about composting, not just focusing on the collection of the materials, as Susan was commenting on, but really looking at prevention. So Eureka just completed and issued a study this past year in which we looked at composting and the benefits of a comprehensive composting system, which wasn't just around how do we collect and process organic material, but how do we prevent materials being generated in the first place, and what's the benefit of that? And two things I'll just point out on that was what we found in the city of St. Paul is the average household is generating about $96 a month of food waste that they're throwing out could have been that was wasted. So it went bad in the refrigerator. It wasn't compostable. It was edible that went bad. So prevention isn't just how do we keep it out of the garbage can and put it in a composting bin. It is also how do we really work with our communities to say how can we handle these materials? How can we buy them? How can we preserve them? How can we save them? There's an environmental benefit to that, obviously, but there's a purse string benefit to households as well. The flip side of it is we also looked at the benefit of if that were to be prevented, what's the savings on communities for collection programs? And there's a flip side savings of another $100 per ton if we aren't generating it and having to manage it in the first place. Mm-hmm. We're able to prevent it. Community programs could save roughly $100 a ton on that as well.
You know, and that's really big news, because the rush is then we identify the material in the waste stream, so now we all have it. It's organics. If you put in the non-recyclable paper, it's a huge amount of material. Let's roll it a bunch of trucks down the street and pick it up. When the real bang for the buck is, how do we prevent that stuff from going into the trash in the first place? And so that's what's so important about having a really solid source reduction goal in addition to recycling and composting goals, is that that's where the true savings is. And then finally, learning from our past to protect our future, this is where we need to really look at these products and packaging. And as I said before, now that we have the brands that know that the resources that they need to package their products or to even create their products are limited, and the price of those are going up, they're harder to get all the time, we have some leverage to say, okay, yes, step up to the table, but also let's look at some of those products and packaging, and let's create some kind of a hierarchy around this, so that this isn't, EPR doesn't just become a scheme to recycle more material. So extended producer responsibility should look at prevention first and foremost. There should be a hierarchy that says reusables and refillable packaging should be rewarded monetarily. Recyclable and compostable packages shouldn't be rewarded. They should have to pay their way. And then if anything isn't recyclable or compostable, and that's over 1 million tons right now of just MSW, municipal solid waste, that should be penalized, and particularly toxic materials. The producers need to step up on all of those products in all of those categories, not just the ones that are going to serve their bottom line because they're recyclable.
So in closing, you know, what is it that we all hope that 25 years from now, when we're sitting at a table like this and we're looking back, what can we say? And we can say that we set visionary goals. We prioritize prevention, that we're measured, funded, and rewarded. We increased and met our progressive recycling and composting goals. And we successfully shared the responsibility between government, communities, and people, and the producers, that can be seen through the products and packaging that is designed for healthy manufacturing, use and reuse, and low or no health or environmental impact at the end of their useful life. We've created jobs for Minnesotans and put local resources to the best use for our local economy, and we've decreased the generation of harmful greenhouse gas emissions and prevented other planetary and human health threats because we reversed this pattern of wasting our resources and changed our patterns. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And we're happy to answer questions.
Questions for members? I don't see any questions at this point. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Felicity Britton? Mike, if I close down there, hold up. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to our presentation. My name is Felicity Britton, and I'm the Executive Director of Linden Hills Power and Light, which is a nonprofit dedicated to reducing our carbon footprint through community engagement. And today I'm here in my role as a member of the Minnesota Composting Council, which is also a nonprofit dedicated to training, education, and advocacy of the compost industry throughout the state. And so that Composting Council is a wide variety of all aspects of the compost industry. So we have members here like Anne, who is from a compost facility that takes all our organics from Minneapolis and Hennepin County and turns them into a beautiful soil. We have Marcus from Carver County, Tim from the pollution control agencies here somewhere, Jim, who's a hauler, who takes the compost in their trucks and processes it. And then Kelly Kish from the city of Minneapolis is also here.
also, I just want to say, sometimes when I give presentations, people come to me at the end and they say, I didn't hear a word you said because your accent, I was trying to place where your accent was from. So I'm just going to say, I'm from Australia. So then you don't have to worry about that anymore. So what the heck is SSO and why would we even bother with it? Why would we ask people to separate this stuff? This is what we're going to cover. So I have a song. Maybe Frank could sing it with me. I don't think I'll sing it. I'll just say it. It's to the tune of my favorite things. Cardboard from fridges and cardboard from freezers, napkins and tissues you've used after sneezes, brown paper packages, even their string. These are a few of your organic things. There's various verses. That's just the non-recyclable paper. I won't go through all the verses of the food waste. But SSO is anything that will break down into dirt if you let it degrade. So it's something that was once alive. So you can see in the slide, there's pizza boxes, coffee filters, Q-tips, and of course our food waste. You'd be surprised how little is left in your trash can after you take the recycling and compostable out. I have a family of four. We have a small Target bag of trash at the end of the week because there really is very little in it. There's ceramics, which you never have, broken glass after a party, latex and rubber. There's very, you know, this plastic is just the stuff that's left in. So it's a huge percentage. Frank actually said 30% of the waste stream, but when you put in the non-recyclable paper, it's 40% of the waste stream that the PCA mentioned this morning. So it's a pretty big piece of our waste stream. So what can we do? Instead of throwing it into the trash, we can make it into a beautiful, rich soil amendment. I don't think I'll go over what is soil. Soil is something that you can plant something in. So what are the benefits? Number one is jobs. So Ginny Black came up with this very great calculation that composting creates 4 local jobs for every 10,000 tons of SSO recycled. That is just jobs at the compost facility. That's people clearing the tipping floor, you know, in a bobcat turning the piles, testing the temperature. That does not include people like Rose, who's in the picture. That's our organics collector from the city of Minneapolis. It doesn't include the truck driver driving that white truck. It doesn't include the people at the transfer station or the people doing education and outreach or the people who are printing the brochures about it. That is just 4 jobs at the compost facility. So you can see that the impact is pretty good for jobs. Improving the soil is really important. So if we compare a carrot today to a carrot from 100 years ago, even if your carrot is from Whole Foods or the co-op and it would cost double the amount, it's got less nutrients than a carrot 100 years ago. And that's because every time we plant something, we're taking nutrients out of the soil, putting that new food item. So every time we plant, we're depleting the soil. So we have farmers and ag who want these nutrients returned to the soil. Water is pretty straightforward. Compost holds water, so you need to irrigate less. That helps everybody. Compost is a natural fertilizer. So synthetic fertilizers are petroleum-based, so they're a fossil fuel resource. They create pollution. So everyone knows that all the stormwater runoff from agricultural areas into our wetlands, lakes, and streams, that's causing dead zones. The dead zones mean there's areas of no oxygen where there's, you know, no fish can live. So we want to reduce those dead zones. We want to reduce the use of synthetic fertilizers and use this beautiful natural fertilizer. So when you put food and biodegradable material in a landfill, it releases methane. Methane has a 70 times more warming power than CO2. So let's get these out. Landfills are responsible for 34% of our methane emissions nationwide. So if we stopped putting biodegradable material in landfills would be the equivalent of closing 20% of our coal-fired plants. We don't want them in there. Landfills are full and filling, and they're very difficult to site. No one wants to live near a new landfill. So if we keep the material out, that's creating excess room for more of the inert material, so the other stuff that we can't recycle or compost, and increasing their lifespan. Also, when you take out the food material, you're going to get less vectors and smell from the landfills because the stuff that's left is inert. The seagulls are not there to peck at cans and bottles. They are there for the food. So sometimes people ask me, well, why don't we just send it to the HERC or a burner where you're going to get waste to energy? And this material is typically wet. It's like lettuce. So the analogy I use is it's like throwing noodles on a campfire. The HERC doesn't want that wet stuff. It takes more energy to keep a light than it creates. So it's actually a net loss of energy when you're putting all those wet items in a fire. So unlike recycling, which gets shipped to China and gets processed there, you can't really ship this stuff. Anyone who knows about the garbage barge knows that you can't just put smelly food waste on a ship and send it somewhere. So these are jobs that are local. The processing, the tipping and collecting is all local. We're close to the source, and it's the local end markets that benefit. So we benefit by having compost used in road construction, so there's less erosion, and we're getting the nutrients back in our food, not Chinese food or overseas food. These figures, I'm not going to read them, but that is just for Minnesota. If we did this nationally, it would be the equivalent of taking 24 million passenger cars off the road. So we have an opportunity to be a leader and say, you know, we're doing something that other states can learn from. So people want it. People want to do it. I get calls nearly every week from neighborhoods or communities saying, how can I get curbside composting in my neighborhood? You're so lucky. You've got it, you know, collected in your neighborhood. Help me figure out how to do it in my neighborhood. And typically I give them Kelly Kish's number and say, call her between 8 and midnight. She'll fix you up. The truth is we're way behind. Collection of residential food waste is widespread in Canada and parts of Europe. The European Union has since 1999 progressively limited organics in landfills, and many countries have banned organics in landfills altogether. So we've got a ways to go. This is not really a new idea. Up until the 50s in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and probably rurally as well, people left out their food scraps in a little pail on their back step, and pig farmers would come and collect it. So keeping food separate from trash is not anything new. It's not difficult. It's very easy, and people want to do it. I love this statistic, though, because it says 77% of people say they understand why it's important, and 68% say they would do it. So that means 9% know it's important but still don't want to do it. So we will get to that 9%. Currently in Minnesota, we have all sorts of programs going on, and they are successful. So in Swift County, they've been going since 2000. It's eight towns and some rural areas. They're running like clockwork. Hutchinson's been going since 2000 with curbside collection. They offered people the opportunity to downsize from a large trash cart to a small trash cart, and 50% of people did that the first year. And then they offered them the ability to go to every other week trash collection, and I think 75% of people are 80% or 90% of people are doing that, and it saves them $20 per month. So they're actually saving money if they downsize their cart and go to every other week collection. In Hutchinson, the city owns the facility, so they collect and process the waste. They sell it to big box stores, so they're actually making a profit by collecting the organics. They are diverting 75% of their waste, with organics making up almost 50% of that diversion and recyclables at 25%. Slightly closer to home, we've been collecting through Hennepin County programs in Orono, Wayzata, Minnetonka, Minneapolis, St. Louis Park. Some of them the city is paying for the cost, and others the households are paying. And there's hundreds and hundreds of schools doing it. So this is my daughter's school, and the kids love it. They just love it, and it's easy for them. We tell them, just think about what a worm would eat. So would a worm eat a tin can? No. Would a worm eat a pizza box? Sure. Would a worm eat your peanut butter crust? Yes. So they know which cart it goes in. It's very simple. The tip fee, currently for Hennepin County, they allow haulers to drop off an organics load at $15 a ton versus dropping at the Herc for $47 a ton. So there's incentives there, and there's ways to save money. And like Susan said, that's just Minnesota. Portland, Oregon is at a 70% diversion rate, and San Francisco is claiming an 80% diversion rate. So there's various ways to spread these costs. There are models where people are collecting it with, co-collecting the organics with trash, or co-collecting with yard waste, or a separate truck, and various models are between $2 to $3 a month per household. So if we look at a way to reduce our carbon footprint, and we compare, this is going to be at worst, say $50 per household per year, versus requiring everyone to have a high efficiency boiler, that's $3,000. Requiring everyone to have an electric car, that's like $30,000. So this is a huge bang for the buck in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, and it's cheap, easy, and we can do it quickly with the changes that we're proposing. You can offset the cost by reducing the trash hauling fees and avoiding the state and county taxes. The state tax is 17% on trash. Compost as a recyclable is exempt from that 17%. In my county, it's an additional 14.5%, so it's 31.5% on my trash bill for trash collection, or if I divert that to compost, that's exempt from that. Commercial businesses can also get on this bandwagon. We worked with General Mills. They reduced their annual trash cost by $10,000. That was just one facility. That's the test kitchen facility. Reduced their trash bill by $10,000 a year. By switching, obviously at a test kitchen, most of your material is food that they microwave, freeze, whatever. So they were able to save a lot of money. Composting our organic material is a win-win-win. We get jobs, we reduce pollution, and we create a valuable resource. One of our haulers pointed out to me that compost is a very stable commodity, whereas aluminum, paper, all of those commodities just have wild price fluctuations. Compost is stable, and it has consistent demand. So, next steps, in 2010, legislators designated soil-separated organics as a recyclable material. Now let's set the goal for getting that out of the waste stream and have a mechanism to require collection. So I truly hope that you will support Frank's bill and give him feedback on how to make it a success. The Compost Council is hoping that soil-separated organic material will be added as a fifth recyclable. So currently, cities, when they're licensing haulers, the haulers are required to pick up four recyclables, which is glass, paper and cardboard, metal, plastic, and we would like a fifth one, which is or separate organic material. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. To the testifier, ma'am, I'm a farmer, and I think we can say we try to produce the most nutritious foods possible. So I'm curious, I'd never heard before your statement that the carrot of 100 years ago was more nutritious than today's. Where did that information come from? And I'd like to look at that and study it.
Okay, I'll get you something on that. Madam Chair, will I get to you, Jean?
So if you would give it to us, we will get it around to all members.
Okay. It's about the depletion of soils, so I'll get that info to you.
Representative Anderson.
Well, I just have to add, Madam Chair, that we don't deplete the soil. We take soil analysis, soil tests, and put back what is taken out. So I don't think that, you know, in a broad scale that our soil is being depleted of nutrients that would have an effect on food analysis, but that's just my opinion, I guess, but that's the way I see it anyway.
We have two studies, and they do the studies.
If you're gonna, we have to have it on the record, please. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if we're gonna get to this. I think you kind of started on a path that I was interested in hearing a little more about today, which is, you talked about the pig farmers of old who used to pick up the food waste that people would put outside on their alleys. We have urban organic farming, urban farming going on, some of it organic, some of it not. So one of the problems, I think it was suggested by the PCA, there's going to be some revisions to the rules that might allow more of that kind of collection, because for now, if you're a farmer who wants to collect some of that waste, there's certain legalities that prevent you from hauling it, and I just know from trying to do some of those things in the city, there are a lot of restrictions, and I don't know if anybody's going to talk about that more in this presentation, because I think, or maybe that's something, Frank, that we could talk about putting in your bill, but it's an incredible resource, as everyone has mentioned, that's pretty much being wasted and costing a lot of money to waste in the process. So, And there's things about how it should be done properly so that those who want to do organic farming can make sure that they're not getting certain things in that mm-hmm. collection, and those who don't care can have a broader base. Or even the breweries and the other folks who want to provide, you know, their food waste. The restrictions on that right now are pretty difficult, and just hauling is illegal in certain regards. So I presume that's some of what the PCA was talking about in the new rules that will be coming out, but I haven't heard much about that yet today. So,
yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Clark, the PCA is working on those rules, and there will be different levels. So like a community garden won't need to be permitted like a compost facility, and there'll be different accommodations for that sort of thing.
Questions from other members? I don't see any. Thank you so much. Paul Gardner's next, and Michael Washburn will be coming up together. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Gardner. I'm the executive director for a nonprofit organization here in St. Paul called Recycling Reinvented. I am here to talk about how we can actually get to a 60% recycling goal in a particular part of the municipal solid waste stream. And we'd like to express support for Representative Hornstein's bill that includes a goal for 60% recycling by 2030. I think the only polite difference we would have with Representative Hornstein is that the market actually needs a lot of this material a lot sooner than 2030, but we'll take it. Okay. We hope you remember just two things from the presentation today. The first is that market demand for much of the recyclable material that we're currently putting out for recycling is higher than the supply. Most consumers don't actually know this. And a lot of American manufacturers, some of whom are represented today through some associations, are actually looking for more material. They might not agree with how we want to go about it, but the demand is definitely there. We hope you also remember that from the presentation that through a recent working paper released yesterday that we've completed, that we believe that we can get to that 60% recycling rate for consumer packaging and printed paper at a cost that roughly is about what consumers and households are paying now in Minnesota. You can return your calls and things now that you remembered those two things. Great. We have a plan, not the plan. There are lots of ideas on how to get higher recycling rates. There was a robust discussion about containers this morning, so we're not here to counter on that. We're here to just present some information that we've discovered. The approach that we're taking is called something very scary to some people in the room, just by the sound of it, extended producer responsibility, or EPR. Sometimes it's referred to as product stewardship. You've passed legislation similar to this on paint and batteries, and also, paint and electronics, and in carpet and batteries, but it didn't get through the Senate, but that's another thing. Just to let the collective blood pressure go down a little bit to those who are watching the archive presentation of this online around the country and some folks in the room, we've talked to committee administrators and committee chairs in both houses and discovered that with a short session, even if we had peace in the valley on our particular legislative approach, there just aren't enough committee slots to get through all the committee stops that you have to in both houses. So I know that's reducing state GDP by reducing billable lobbyist hours here to do that, but I just wanted people to know that unless something else gives us an open pathway, we think that we're not quite ready for prime time yet, and we'd like to have peace in the valley rather than a messy end of life in the abyss. A little bit about us. Recycling Reinvented is a 501c3 organization. We were created 2 years ago, and our sole purpose is to advocate and educate on this particular model for packaging and printed paper through extended producer responsibility. We always get questions about how we're funded. We have a lion's share of our funding from Nestle Waters North America, which is the third largest non-alcoholic beverage company in the U.S., and Mr. Washburn here is to represent them here today. We've also had funding from the second largest craft brewer in the United States, New Belgium, in Colorado, as well as the Roy A. Hunt Foundation in New York. Our organization was created in part because of a chance meeting of two people on an airplane, two people who would describe themselves as being completely different. Kim Jeffrey, the now retired CEO of Nestle Waters CEO, who describes himself as a conservative Republican, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's a noted environmental activist on the left. I think the two of them would completely disagree on 95% of most topics, but on the issue of recycling, they found out that they had a common interest, one for environmental reasons and one for economic reasons. The reason I mention this is because our organization is often typecast in one of two ways. Either we are trying to import socialism from Europe and Canada, on one hand, or we are trying to facilitate the corporate takeover of recycling. And I just say that because we're trying to thread a needle, and so depending on who you talk to, we tend to be perceived in different ways. I wanted to say that the reason we're looking at Minnesota is actually because we have done some things right in Minnesota. Madam Chair and Representative Kahn probably were part of passing amendments to the Solid Waste Act in the early 90s that resulted from a commission that Governor Perpich set up called SCORE. And we have one of the higher recycling rates, at least compared to states in the U.S., not compared to other industrialized countries, because of a couple key elements. We actually have laws in the books that say communities over a certain size have to have curbside collection, and all counties have to have convenient opportunities to recycle otherwise. We also have a volume-based pricing statute, which is very rare in the United States, that says as you throw away more, you must pay more. That helps incentivize recycling. It also makes sure that we actually pay for garbage. When I go around the country, particularly further east, a lot of people pay for garbage as part of their general taxes, and they can't actually tell what they're paying for. So they actually have an incentive by seeing a line item fee, whether you're in Minneapolis or Moorhead, where you can actually figure out what you're paying. That has resulted in more transparency and trying to think about how to recycle more. We also have the Solid Waste Management Tax, which brings in a little more than $60 million a year. I think some members who know about this know that there's some leakage from that. 30% of that goes by statute to the general fund. $14 million of that goes to counties to help support recycling as well as household hazardous waste activities and other waste-related actions. It also helps clean up old landfills, so those are good things. But not all of it goes to solid waste. So overall, state directives and goals, as well as local government actions to put those goals forward, and private sector investment have led to a relatively successful rollout of infrastructure in Minnesota over the last 20 years. But we are stuck. And that's important because the market actually needs the material. I did some polling in 2005 with another organization and found that only about one-third of Minnesotans actually know that the market needs more material. That's been the case for at least a decade. It's turning into an acute problem in several sectors, namely in PET plastic, high-density polyethylene plastic, polypropylene, which is PP, sorry, that's what that means. I don't mean to gross anybody out there. Glass, aluminum, and many different paper grades. So supply and demand for recyclable material has been out of alignment for some time. And usually in the marketplace for other types of commodities, if you offer a higher price, it causes people to create more. That doesn't really happen in recycling because it's been seen as a public service, and so local governments are doing a great job, but they don't respond to whatever the market price is in the London Metals Exchange for steel and aluminum on any given day. We have run across a lot of brands that are willing to actually invest some money in the system, whether it's philanthropic or a cost of doing business, but they have a problem that we call a free rider problem and a problem of scale. Big companies do things big or they don't do it. So they've said, we're not interested in doing pilot projects at a city level. What would it take to increase recycling at the statewide level? I think rural members would also recognize the problem with free riders. There's a great analogy here with agricultural checkoff programs that USDA has, where groups are trying to get more promotion and education money for a particular commodity, and they have to go through a process so that all producers are in, so that you don't have free riders in the system. There's something very similar to that problem with us. The other issue, which is, depending on your point of view, good or bad, 40% of U.S. recyclables nationwide, not necessarily in Minnesota, go for export. Usually exporting is a good thing, but we actually have manufacturers in the U.S. who can't get enough stuff because they're putting it in the ground. So the concept of EPR is similar to what you've done with paint and electronics, which is the consumer brands would pay for recycling rather than households and ratepayers. It's our belief that brands are better able to scale up best practices on the largest scale possible. That's what they do in retail and manufacturing and other things. They also would be able to use their purchasing power to get a better deal on recycling services. We're not suggesting that consumer brands would or even want to own any assets in the recycling system, but they can use their purchasing power, similar to the State Department of Administration does in state contracts, to get a better deal through vendors to provide services. The folks at Eureka gave some other examples of what EPR can do. Those aren't really the focus of our the study I'll mention in a minute. So Mr. Washburn here representing Nestle Waters and I have been around the country for the last 3 years since my liberation by the voters. And we've gotten different reactions. We've talked to a lot of consumer brands, a lot of their suppliers and retailers, as well as organized labor, local and state government, environmental groups, and haulers. There certainly is not a uniform reaction. One reason that we're not trying to push a bill yet is because we do not have alignment among all of those sectors. But we have, particularly from the folks who would foot the bill, heard two things very clearly that overlap with our interests for higher recycling, and that is risk of two things. Because of emerging economies consuming more resources, the global supply of lots of commodities, not just packaging and paper, is getting tighter. That means if we do nothing, prices tend to go up. And as I mentioned, higher prices don't necessarily equate into more supply in recycling. It helps, but it hasn't had the desired effect. So a lot of brands are concerned about the volatility of that commodity pricing, and they feel that there's a risk of inaction if they don't do anything to see increased rates. The other issue, and I have actually been a contributor to this problem when I served in this body, is patchwork government action. We have two existing EPR laws, one for paint and one for electronics. The one in electronics is highly effective. for Minnesota, but 25 states have 25 different laws that all have different compliance requirements and fees and covered materials. That's mostly because the industry did not get behind a uniform model. So it causes a big compliance issue to have different laws to deal with. The paint industry got behind a uniform model and has been supporting it, and now we've seen legislation passed in seven states, including Minnesota. So we would rather come forward when we have a little bit more of a uniform model that people get behind, rather than try and throw a bill at the wall and see if it gets through in part or in whole, and then try that in other states and get to different results. So that's a risk we're very conscious of from folks we've met with and we want to avoid. The good news is, compared to when I first got into recycling 16 years ago, everyone agrees that we need to do something to get higher rates for different reasons. So agreeing on the problem is often the biggest problem to get over, and we've gotten there. And now companies have said, and policymakers, not just here in Minnesota, but in other states like North Carolina and Rhode Island and Delaware, where we've also worked on legislation, have said, what would this look like, how much would it cost, and what kind of benefits would we get for it compared to what we're doing now? So we commissioned a cost-benefit study in three parts. The cost-benefit part of it has just been released on Monday. In your packet, you should have a three-page executive summary with the highlights. We asked a consulting firm, which, for full disclosure, was the same one that did the container deposit study that was discussed this morning, and we asked them four questions. What kind of results are we getting now in recycling, and what is it costing consumers? We asked them what results might be possible with the tools that could be scaled up through a producer finance system, and then what's it going to cost? We also wanted to find out where that material is going. It didn't seem to be a good use of time if all the new tons that might be recovered in Minnesota as a result of public policy went to China. There is some value to it, but as you can imagine, some people would say that's maybe not okay. We also asked two dozen expert reviewers, people who have been following this issue from all sectors, to let us know what they think of the data that we put together. We specifically asked people who don't agree with us that this is the way to go, and they probably still will not agree with us, but we wanted them to at least give us their ideas and let us know what they thought. And we have some people who sort of like what we're doing, but not everything. But we have tried to be as transparent as we can with the data that we have. So we wanted to see what we do now. We had to use 2001 as our base year. That's the one year with all the data sets kind of line up in common. And we found out that, and I apologize for all the percentages here because it doesn't comport with the stuff you heard before. We're talking about consumer packaging, which is about a fifth of all municipal solid waste, or MSW. So when a state has a recycling rate, they're measuring out of everything. We're measuring of just consumer packaging. So we believe we're recycling about 46% of our recyclable packaging and printed paper. That's 452,000 tons. The cost to households to provide that service through a utility bill, a hauler bill, or your property taxes, we had to find a range because we have a lot of subscription hauling where you pick your hauler, and we couldn't just call up everybody who gets their own price and sample. But we believe that we're paying about $61 to $74 million. A few of you have heard some other numbers from me earlier when that looked like more like 80, and with some revision in our assumptions, it actually is lower. So we're actually paying lower than we thought, but not a small amount of money. Of all households in Minnesota, 70% of them have direct collection, meaning they have curbside collection, or if you're in an apartment building, they have a container at their building. Of that number of households, 60% of them have what's called single-stream recycling, where you have one cart and you put everything together. The materials that are collected in communities in Minnesota vary wildly. The PCA did a curbside recycling survey, and they discovered that there are varying types of materials that are collected, even that might have single stream, even that have the same hauler in different communities. And the price per household for contracts to cities varies wildly. We did not want to embarrass anybody in any particular community, but if you look at a table of publicly available information of what consumers are paying per household for roughly the same service in the areas with the same demographics, the differences are quite staggering, and that usually has to do with whether a city wants to actually drive the hardest bargain. Statewide, we also found that of our material recovery facilities, these are the recycling centers where you have the conveyor lines and people sorting and high-tech equipment, that overall we're using only 50% of the capacity that we have. That doesn't mean that every MRF, as we call it, is half full. It just means there's an assumption here that you're at full capacity if you operate that facility 5 days a week, two shifts a day. Some recycling centers do that, and I would say a lot do not, particularly in rural Minnesota. So if you were to look at all the throughput that we're putting through those facilities, we could actually double the amount of materials that those facilities can handle. So in our cost-benefit study, we asked our contractor to look at some best practices that are known to work and get results on a smaller level, and asked them what would happen to our state's recycling rate for consumer packaging if we scaled this up at the state level. So the rule of thumb nationwide is that you ought to spend about $1 per household for education. We doubled that because we wanted to do some statewide education campaigning. We asked what would happen if everybody had single stream, who can get direct collection, like at the curb. That's easier said than done. We discovered there is enough density in communities in Minnesota that aren't required to collect now that would actually be able to get curbside collection. So we could go from 70% of households having direct collection to 87% and have the density that's necessary to make that work. And we would focus on harmonizing the materials so that the same materials would be collected everywhere. That allowed us to line up all the data in line for the projections. And finally, we also have a comprehensive away-from-home component. This is modeled very heavily on Manitoba, which has some good data, where the beverage industry, in that case, paid for recycling containers in public spaces, parks, and the like. And so we were able to model how much tonnage we could get from that. So the results we found were good. I want to be frank here. We said, can we get to a 75% recycling rate? And the data said, no, we can't get there. So I had to throw that aspirational goal and get over it. We did find that we could get close, though. We actually could collect over 70% of household consumer packaging that goes to households. But because of what you might say in manufacturing is process loss, in recycling we call it residue, stuff that isn't supposed to be there or stuff that got missed, we subtracted that, and we got 66% of all household packaging could be recycled, and 61% if you include consumer packaging that's disposed of at work and on the go. So that actually lined up very nicely with Representative Hornstein's approach with 60%. So it is at least possible, using certain assumptions, assuming that they happen, to get that 60% number. In terms of, I should say clearly that legislation isn't required to do the things to get that number. We think it would be necessary to accelerate it to actually get it to happen quicker and in a more uniform way. But we have talked to some companies who have said, what other ways can we do it? How can we scale up best practices? And so we are talking to some of them. But in terms of the cost part, this is where the producer financing system gets some market efficiency to lower costs. The basic assumption here is that consumer brands acting collectively could get a better deal on a regular or on a region-wide and statewide basis by driving a hard bargain with vendors to get the best value and to specify terms in contracts. We would want to keep a competitive market for hauling. We don't have any no plan to say one hauler should get the entire state. We want to make sure that Bob's Hauling and Refuse can compete in this kind of marketplace along with Waste Management and Republic. We discovered that if you use that approach with purchasing and do all the things I just mentioned to do the best practices to scale things up, that has a price tag of $72 million to collect all of that material. That's compared to the baseline of $61 to $74 million. So we're in the range. We could get better results for roughly the same price. Here's a controversial part of our proposal, and that is a rationalization of that MRF capacity that's at 50%. If the brands were to say, let's send material to a certain facility that needs more material or that has better value because they have higher quality, that's where some of the folks in the room who operate the current system would get a little bit nervous and say, well, how do we fit into that system? And that's another reason we don't have peace in the valley. We would like for there to be more dialogue in the year to come to explain how everybody fits in that system. But if we were to focus on filling that capacity and focusing on the highest efficiency, that would save us some more money and get us down to $64 million. So there would be some administrative costs, enforcement costs, and market development costs that are not included in this that would probably inch it up back up towards $70 million. But we were pleased that we could increase recycling by about a third, and it would cost households and consumers about the same. There's some fine print here. We're projecting that everything would happen at once, which I think is a very unlikely thing, particularly that there are contracts in place for vendors right now, and we don't really have an interest in trying to void contracts. We would want to see people pooled into the system as contracts expire. We don't address a very dicey issue, which is the control and ownership of the assets. Again, brands are not interested in driving trucks or owning recycling facilities. But they may say, we want to purchase services from this vendor instead of that vendor, which can result in changes in what assets are being used. So that is an extremely delicate topic. But we're including some startup costs in this, but not others. So a new truck is not included in the cost, but the fueling, maintenance, and the driver for that truck is included. We're also not including interaction with existing score funds. It's too hard to actually extract where all the score money is going compared to what we want to do, so we just left that alone. And we also had to use the 2011 base year as data, so some of the changes that we're suggesting are going to happen anyway. So Roseville, Minneapolis, St. Paul switching to single stream is not included because it's happening after 2011. So that 32% increase is actually going to get smaller, but I just wanted to let you know that that's what we had to do with the data. For next steps, we have an additional working paper we're working on to calculate what the fees would look like. So what would that translate to per soda can, per cereal box, per magazine, per whatever? And so we're working on a formula with our consulting firm to figure that out. And then we're going to present it to a lot of the consumer brands we've talked to say, is the benefit of getting this much material in the marketplace worth that kind of cost to you? We'll also look at where this material goes. We've talked to labor in particular, who are very sensitive about where material goes. There are union jobs at manufacturers in the U.S. that aren't getting material that is going to China, and that's something that's of particular interest to them. So the full study will be complete by March of this year. And I just wanted to conclude and say this isn't the only way to approach the issue. We think it would be the fastest way and probably the most market-based way to get at this issue. But we're moving people's cheese with this idea, and so that's a very delicate topic. So we want to have discussions with people about what the data says and see where that leads us in the year to come. We're always open to different ideas. We've talked to a lot of people who have lots of views in recycling. I wish we all could come forward with a common proposal today, but I think we all can get behind Representative Hornstein's goal of 60%. I'm going to stop there, and I would I'd like to turn it over to Michael Washburn, who can speak from the brand perspective here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I was just instructed to keep it short, which is not my tendency, but I'll do the best that I can.
If you'd put your name on the record.
I appreciate the chance to
just
to come
say your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Thank you. So I'm Michael Washburn. I'm a consultant to Nestle Waters. I served previously as its vice president for sustainability. And I'm really just here to validate, I guess, some of the things that have been said about my company in particular, or about companies generally, as they think about limited commodities on a global basis. So as Paul mentioned, Nestle Waters is the nation's third largest non-alcoholic beverage company. And we've been outspoken advocates of the concept of extended producer responsibility for several years for a range of reasons, one of which is that this phenomenon of EPR is sweeping the globe and has grown rapidly here in the United States in recent decades, as you have evidenced yourselves in your passage of EPR legislation related to products like electronics. So our view is if left alone, EPR could happen in ways that might be contradictory to some of our business interests. We think there's a moment here where the public interest, which is your charge, and the private interests that we have in securing long-term availability of limited commodities can actually match up and work very well together. We also think it's a compelling notion that maybe the way we've historically treated recycling, which has been solely the purview of municipal governments and state governments to organize and deliver, that maybe there is a different approach to that. And as Susan Hubbard mentioned, we are one company and there are others who are willing to, prepared to, bring some money to the table and take on the financial obligations associated with the recovery and recycling of our packages. Yes, we want to do that for our own narrow interests. Nestle Waters uses a tremendous amount of PET plastic in our bottles. We also use low-density polyethylene plastic to wrap our cases. We use corrugated cardboard. We want to see all that material coming back. And we have a goal that we set in 2008 to effectively double the beverage container recycling rate by 2018. One of the reasons we set that goal was to signal that there is urgency on our part in getting this material back. As Paul mentioned, with agricultural commodities, if there's demand expressed in the market, producers can respond, prices can adjust, you can meet demand. Unfortunately for us, we're creating demand for recycled material. We know that there's recycled material available, but there's a middle player here. And it's that fragmented, not very well aligned, one jurisdiction at a time recycling program that exists across the landscape. So we want to see that get aligned. We heard from the MPCA there's $210 million a year in Minnesota alone of recyclable packaging being laid to waste. Nationally, that's about $11 billion a year of material. So we know there's supply, and we've heard Paul and others say, and you're hearing my company say, that there's demand. So there's something in the middle that has to adjust. We think that if EPR were adopted, we could change that supply and demand relationship and get it better aligned. We think that we could meet the demands of some of your own manufacturers here in this state. Think about companies like NewPage Paper or Rock 10, who rely on recovered fiber, or companies like Anchor Glass, who use recycled glass. Those are companies who create jobs and are going to need this material into the future to continue to sustain those jobs. So we do favor legislation. We agree that now is not the time. We want to work with all of you to get the kind of political alignment we need. And we're very interested in having this conversation in a productive way so that we can meet recycling goals, but also protect the public interest and do this in the most holistic, low-cost way possible for your citizens. So I'll stop there because I'm really eager to hear any of your questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there questions, members? I don't see any right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll get it all worked out by 2030.
I think you've got a shorter timeline than that.
Thank you.
Aaron Kaiser?
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Erin Kaiser. I'm a senior civil engineering student at the University of Minnesota, minoring in sustainability, and my focus is in waste management. I'm a hazardous waste site certified operator, and I spent the summer with an environmental consulting firm where I visited lots of landfills doing groundwater testing as well as some construction. I'm also a work-study intern at Eureka Recycling, so I don't have a PowerPoint or statistics or numbers for you, but I am comfortable with and like to talk trash. More specifically, I like to talk about zero waste initiatives and how to get there, but I understand that we need to start small, and I believe that Frank's bill is a way to do that. I think that waste reduction by means of recycling and composting is one of the greatest ways to make real strides in combating climate change. I'm a person who is younger than the previous recycling goals for the metro area, and when I think about the social improvements that have been seen in 21 years, I can't believe that a state like ours is using guidelines and goals that are simply outdated. Climate change is happening, and by burning and burying recyclables and organics, we are not helping its progress. So along with being a 21-year-old, I'm also a student at the University of Minnesota, like I said, and I'll soon be looking for work. And the employment opportunities added to the job market through recycling and composting initiatives are exciting and also proven to be promising. I believe Tim Brownell from Eureka said that roughly 36,000 jobs would be created through goals like this one. And can we all just imagine what that means for my generation and the generations like the ones to come? I believe green jobs are the future, and I have seen how they can improve a community by working at Eureka. If we look to communities like San Francisco, they're well on their way to zero waste, so why aren't we? We can be a leader in a green future and a role model to be followed as long as we take initiatives like this, which we see can work in states like California, Washington, and Oregon. We're ready. The metro area is ready. My generation is ready. Your generation is ready. Minnesota is ready. Give people a chance to compost, and then let's evaluate what's in our trash. I think this proposal is the first of many steps to provide future generations with a sustainable and healthy lifestyle. We need a unified front in policy to increase recycling and composting in order to get to zero waste and a greener future. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions, members? Don't see any questions. Thank you. We're going to have Josh Winters and then Commissioner Reinhart.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Josh Winters, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, better known as MPIRG, a statewide grassroots nonpartisan student-directed organization that empowers and trains students and engages the community to take collective action in the public interest throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'm here today on behalf of the students and community members we represent across the state. To testify in support of establishing clear objectives and incentives for recycling and composting. MPIRG strongly supports establishing an objective of a 60% diversion rate for recyclables and a 15% diversion rate for compostable materials or organics. We also strongly support the Recycling Refund Act to create better incentives for diverting recyclables materials from landfills and garbage burners. The reliance upon landfills and incinerators to manage our waste is, from our perspective, one of the dirtiest secrets we have in this state and, frankly, this country. Once we throw something in the garbage can, few think about what happens to that waste next. We conceal this garbage in landfills obscured from our view. We conceal it when it's burned by putting pollutants in the air and creating toxic ash landfills from what remains after the incineration process. And the reality of the challenges presented by incineration and landfills necessitate that we lift the veil on what are rampant and, from our perspective, cavalier practices of simply throwing trash away means for our health, for our communities, for our environment, and for economic development. This is doable. In places where recycling and composting have been embraced, we've seen amazing results. And we don't have to look across the country to find them. They're right here in Minnesota, and many of the other testifiers spoke to this. In Elk River, in less than a year, more than 53 tons of organic waste were diverted from landfills and recycled by 450 residents. In Hutchinson, they had a pilot program launched in the late 90s and was then rolled out to the entire city with a 98% participation rate recorded. And more recently in Hennepin County, pilot programs have diverted 1,800 tons of organic material from landfills in 2008, 6,800 tons in 2009, and more than 10,000 tons in 2010 in neighborhoods like Seward and Linden Hills. When we educate, engage, and ask this of our residents, they rise to the challenge. We need to stop selling short the willingness and ability of Minnesotans to do what is needed to avoid this unnecessary and wasteful practice. At MPERC, we have talked to tens of thousands of community members and students across the state about the need and opportunities presented by better solid waste management policies and practices. Quite simply, they understand the need and support policies that move this forward. This is much the same as was found when strong recycling programs were established over the last four decades. Community members participated in these programs, and it is now considered a largely ubiquitous practice that few of us question. These recycling and composting and, objectives create the right policy environment to shift to the least cost approach to solid waste management. Landfilling and garbage incineration are the most expensive and least preferred ways to manage waste, as shown in the Metropolitan Solid Waste Management Master Plan. And yet, 61% of our waste is handled in this manner. By changing this dynamic, we not only utilize the most cost-effective approach, we get all the benefits that recycling and composting offer our communities and the economy. We have a huge opportunity in front of us, and by setting forth strong goals to divert this waste, or perhaps better put, this resource, we can avoid the high costs associated with landfills and incineration, protect public health and the frontline communities disproportionately impacted by these less than desirable management practices. We can create jobs, reduce global warming emissions, and utilize the most economically efficient management tactics. So on behalf of MPERG, our student leaders across the state who have prioritized this issue, the community members we have engaged with overwhelming support of these policies, we would strongly urge your support of this proposed legislation this upcoming session. Thank you. We'd be happy to answer questions.
I don't see any questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Next is Commissioner Reinhart. And as she comes up, let me explain what we will do after that. I am going to welcome public testimony on Representative Hornstein's bill or extended producer responsibility in general. Then I'm going to invite Assistant Commissioner Kadelka up to do a handout on the bottle bill, just a very brief handout, and if there are questions there, but I want you all to know that we will have additional discussions later. This is not the end, but welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Victoria Reinhart. I'm on the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I chair the 6 Metro County Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which you've often heard called Swim Club. I prefer to call it the Coordinating Board. it is the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. Is the joint powers. The counties are Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington. It was established in 1993, and the purpose of the coordinating board was to increase the efficiency and the effectiveness of the solid waste management system. In other words, garbage doesn't recognize county boundaries, and we figured that we could do better and serve the region better environmentally and economically by joining forces and trying to improve that the effectiveness of the system and Minnesota's environment, obviously. We have consistently partnered with state agencies and have really worked together on waste management issues, and that includes not only the state agencies but the municipalities, the industries, and the counties, everybody kind of working together to try to figure out how can we do this the best way. Sometimes we're in agreement and sometimes we're not. And basically, again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to guide and jointly implement solid waste programming that will assure efficiencies and savings for counties and cities. And we believe that we have been very effective in that, in increasing efficiencies and realizing cost savings. We provide increased effectiveness of the solid waste management system in the region and act as an administrative partner to the state. And so when we put together the regional master plan and submit that to the state, we do a lot of things in conjunction with each other so that we can provide information to the state, which makes it easier for them to compile the information, and it just administratively is less expensive and less complicated. Each year, the coordinating board adopts legislative policies, and I understand that you have a packet that has three handouts. The first is the 2014 legislative priorities, and I will briefly go over. There are five on this. It's the first sheet of your packet. We support the state solid waste management hierarchy, and the enforcement of 473.848. And that is designation of waste, ensuring capacity for the waste to energy. Secondly is the coordinating board supports product stewardship efforts that create, expand, or improve product stewardship policies for mattresses, compact fluorescent light bulbs, electronic waste, and pharmaceutical waste. And we are very supportive of the legislation that was just passed regarding paint care and its implementation within the state. And that's rolling out, has already begun, but it's rolling out this year. The third and the fifth one, the next one, the third one, I will go into more detail on. That is the coordinating board supports increasing SCORE funding to counties by directing existing solid waste management tax revenues from the state's general fund, that portion of it that goes into the general fund, to SCORE. Again, I'll come back to that. Fourth, the coordinating board supports MPCA efforts to improve the collection and reporting of solid waste data. Because as we look at the hierarchy and the goals and so forth, being able to measure that and report that is going to be critical, and to try to do that in the most effective and efficient way possible is important to all of us. And finally, the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board supports the establishment of a landfill diversion goal. And again, measurement is so important, and accurate measurement is very important, and I will go into more detail regarding that as well. One thing that I think the people that have testified before and probably after me will agree is that recycling is the key. We appreciate every dollar that we've gotten from SCORE, but they are by no means adequate to the task of recycling and meeting the state's policy plan, which has adopted a 60% recycling target by 2030. Additional state funding is needed, and there is a logical source for that funding that's consistent with earlier solid waste management policy, and that's the solid waste management tax. It was enacted specifically to fund recycling. And SCORE, as many of you know, or maybe I've just been around this too long, the Select Committee on Recycling and the Environment, I believe was under Governor Perpich's administration, to really provide funding to help us achieve this, because counties are required by state statute to implement and to reach these recycling goals. Only a small amount, as you've heard before, of the tax collected is actually distributed to the counties for recycling. In 2013, over $70 million was collected from this tax, and only $14.3 million was provided in SCORE grants to counties. And this is the third handout in your packet, and it's entitled the Coordinating Board Counties Summary of SCORE Grant Dollars. And you will see on there, the top bracketed part is how our SCORE funds grants funded. And currently, it is 70% going to the Environmental Fund, 30% going to the general fund. The SCORE grants to the counties, WLSSD, annual amount is determined by the PCA, and you can see that the $14.3 million has remained very constant, well, since 2010 and before that, actually. And if the portion that we are talking about and that is included in Representative Hornstein's proposed legislation is the state general fund, so that is the... We have MPCA SCORE grants and then the state general fund. So what we are asking for is this additional 20%, excuse me, additional 30% or $21.1 million in addition to the 14.3. You will also notice on this page that it talks about the amount of money that counties are already spending on recycling efforts. In addition, and this is in addition to what we've received, the $14.3 million, you can see that the counties have received, in addition to what we are receiving, this is what we are spending statewide. In 2010, it was $43.4 million, and going to 2012, it's $52.2 million. And that's in addition to. So clearly, there is an investment by county governments across the state of Minnesota to try to achieve this goal, but we need more help. And it's and this is a source that we believe is an appropriate one. I would really like to thank Representative Hornstein for including this in the legislation, and deeply appreciate the fact that your committee is taking testimony on this. It is really critical to us achieving this very the goal of 60%. Counties, as I mentioned, are tasked by the state to plan and implement recycling programs, and it has become an ever-increasing unfunded mandate. And I don't think that's a surprise to anyone here. The SCORE funds do cover only about 15 to 30% of the county's actual recycling and HHW management programs. And in the metro counties, almost all of it, all of the SCORE funding is passed on directly to cities so that they can manage their programs. For all of the coordinating board counties, 76% is passed through directly to municipalities, 15% is spent on household hazardous waste programs, and 9% on other recycling programs like yard waste. The coordinating board's primary legislative goal is to increase SCORE funding to counties by directing existing solid waste management tax revenues from the state's general fund to SCORE. The other legislative principles that are important to the coordinating board that I said I would come back to is the codifying the landfill diversion target. It would bring a concentrated effort and focus on achieving the state's number one solid waste priority, while also simplifying reporting requirements and improving accuracy in solid waste performance measurements. Regardless of the recycling targets or goals set by the state, the only accurate measurement to rely upon is how much waste continues to be landfilled. It is measurable. The state already collects this information not only from landfills in Minnesota but from neighboring states as well. So we know how much is going in. And if we have a diversion goal, we'll be able to truly measure that so that we know when we are achieving the goals that have been established by the state. We look forward to working with the MPCA on regional targets for recycling and organics in the current policy plan already adopted by the state. Again, the 60% recycling target, we believe, can only be reached if the region is and businesses are actively recycling. Private businesses are involved in waste management recycling activities, but their data is confidential because of the competitive nature of the marketplace. A lot of staff and taxpayer dollars, both locally and at the state level, are spent trying to count how much is recycled or source reduced. A significant savings to these expenditures would be to focus instead on a landfill diversion goal. Again, the state already receives this information, and we could easily be able to measure this and know that we're making the goal that has been set by the state. I think with that, I know that you also have included in your packet the second one is the funding for recycling, which talks about jobs and economic development and conserving natural resources and improvements to the environment. And with that, I will stand for questions. I know I've covered a lot of material in a short period of time.
You did, but I appreciate the hand. I particularly appreciate this. Members, are there questions for Commissioner? I don't. Oh, yes, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ms. Reinhart, thank you for your testimony. Just curious, in your six-county area, are you also around that 41% recycling rate, recovery rate?
I believe that we are a little above that. You know what I heard about it? Are we? Okay, at about 41.
Do you want to say that again for the record?
We are at about 41% recycling rate. We have put together the state puts together the policy plan, and then the metro counties provide their master plan and how they're going to achieve the goals and are moving forward. If you look at some of the individual goals, such as organics, if you take it and separate it out, there are some areas where we've already met those, and then there are other areas where we have not.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you for coming. And now we will have, let's not hand that out yet. Before we move on to another topic, which we're going to spend very few minutes on, I would like to know if anybody here would like to testify about Representative Hornstein's bill or extended producer responsibility. And I would welcome you to come up.
Madam Chair, I'm John Helmers. I'm the Director of Environmental Resources for Olmsted County in Rochester, Minnesota. And I'm actually here representing the Solid Waste Administrators Association of Minnesota and the Association of Minnesota Counties. And also we are a member of the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association, which represents about a third of the counties, so we're covering two hats here. And they do reduce, those counties that are using waste energy facilities are reducing the amount of the waste going to their landfills and supplanting fossil fuel uses. And they do produce clean energy that are used by our businesses in our communities for food processing, industrial product processing, district heating and cooling of buildings, and sending electricity to the electrical grid. In Rochester, 37 buildings rely on the energy from waste to cool or heat their buildings and or electrical services. And I'm here to provide the committee with some information on county solid waste management programs and funding of these programs. As you're aware, Minnesota, the state, has tasked the counties with managing all of the solid wastes that are produced within the state, not just select portions of them. And there are 87 counties and probably as many variations on how they do that in that number. The funding in particular for solid waste management services and recycling in particular is quite varied, but every county does value greatly the amount of money that comes to them from the solid waste management tax through the SCORE redistribution. And I'll talk a little bit about that later, what the policy positions are of the SWAT and the solid waste administrators and the Association of Minnesota Counties. But when you look at how counties utilize those funds, the ones that do have waste energy facilities, they don't use it to subsidize the waste energy facilities. They use it to promote the recycling and the waste abatement and all of the diversion activities that they are mandated to do and have really bought into the hierarchy, the waste hierarchy. It is one of the principles that I and my colleagues, and I do have some of them here from around the state that also braved the roads to get here, some as far as from Boston, so we should give them a medal or something. And of the $70 million that's collected, approximately $70 million that's collected by the solid waste management tax, only $14 million is coming back to the states, and that has not changed for many, many years. So, while our responsibilities have continued to grow, the state funding has not. We also fund the additional $52 million that doesn't count to what the municipalities generally, not all of them are like in the metro area where they pass things on to the municipalities. If the municipalities don't do it, the counties do. And just a few quick examples. The Perham facility in Todd, Wadena, Becker, and Ottawa counties, they use each of those counties uses a countywide service fee to collect money from their residences and businesses to generate the monies that they're needed to run their programs. And Todd and Wadena each receive the minimum score of $55,000, but they each spend in excess of $300,000 on recycling and waste abatement activities. Otter Tate County receives $140,000 per year from SCORE, and they spend over $1 million of money towards those activities. And Polk County Waste Energy in Foston has five counties in its area, and it's removing with a front-end material recovery facility 20 to 25% of the waste stream that's delivered to them. That's over and above the source-separated recycling that happens and the collection that's done in those communities. They reclaim materials such as cardboard, ferrous, and aluminum. They also accept without charge the source-separated organic collections that were. Source-separate recyclable collections that were from communities in neighboring counties and the private waste haulers. And they spend, in 2012, they spent $988,000 on recycling and $417,000 on their waste energy facility. And they also fund a waste yard waste composting facility. In Olmsted County, most everyone within broadcast range of Rochester has heard there's a proper place for all your waste in Olmsted County. That's our slogan. A long time, we've used it to promote the solid waste management hierarchy over 20 years, and we encourage waste reduction, reduce reuse, food to people, and food to animals. We have a thriving collection system of various entities that are doing that. We like to say that's our heritage from Dr. Will, set that up back in the 1930s to do the collection of the food waste out of the hospitals and take it out to the pig farms, and that activity is still going on today. Source separated recycling, where people bring it to the facilities themselves, as well as single stream recycling at the households, yard waste composting, and we expect increased volumes of source separated organic composting. And our SCORE recycling number last year was 48%. We recycle 48% of our waste stream, and that does not include those 5 and 3% credits that were previously used as part of that number. So we're doing very well on that. And last year, our county board realigned the hauler collected service fee, which is what we use to supplement our energy revenues and our tipping fee revenues to pay for our completely integrated system. And we removed the service fee from commercial recycling, trying to increase the commercial recycling in our communities. So you do not pay any service fee on the recyclable component. And all of our fees are based on volume. So the more you throw in the bin to go to disposal, the higher your bill is. And in addition to that, you can avoid the tax if you put it in the recycling bin, both the state tax and the hauler collected fee that we use locally. Counties with resource recovery or waste energy facilities usually recycle more of their waste streams than counties that landfill their waste. County programs and public policies are focused on recycling and meeting the state's goal not to landfill, but to use the resources in the waste. And many counties are proceeding to develop source-separate organics and other composting operations as well. The Solid Waste Administrators Association has a platform plank that is to increase the SCORE amounts coming back to the communities. And we were asking for the growth on the amount that has been growing over the years since 2009, I believe. Our bosses, the AMC Association, are actually a little more aggressive than that. They want 100% of the revenues of the solid waste management tax come back to the counties, because the counties are the people that have to deal with all of the waste stream. And I would encourage you, in considering some of these other alternatives that are coming forward, is to consider what it will do to those existing county programs and what will the counties be left with in order to sustain the remainder of the programs that aren't going to be addressed by these specialized focused approaches. The remainder of the programs that aren't going to be addressed by these specialized, focused approaches. And with that, I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I may have missed it, but did you give us your rate of composting?
Our rate of composting is, we do yard, well, what we've been actively doing is encouraging people to compost in their backyards. The first thing that you don't want to do is to haul this stuff around and you know, produce greenhouse gas emissions by hauling it. So we've had a strong program of subsidized backyard compost barrels. That was one of our successes. We ended up with a nonprofit that took over that operation, and were able to end up making some money. We created demand for these, and then they were able to step in and take it over and make it a fundraiser for themselves. And they added rain barrels as well, so they're actually actively selling both of those. So it's a little unclear, because we don't ask for people to report how much of that composting is going on. And then in addition to that, the county operates a yard waste composting facility, and we generally get about 10,000 cubic yards of material through that facility in a year. And we are expecting a proposal from a nonprofit to do something similar, where they would come in and operate that facility and take it over and start making some money for themselves. And then the county could step back from that operation. So, and they're talking about adding source-separated organics as well. And of course, it all comes down to the bottom line. We have an effective tipping fee. If you combine what the haulers pay at the gate plus the hauler collected service fee, of approximately $160 a ton. So there's a great incentive to put it into the recycling bin, where you aren't paying for that, and especially now that also is the fees to collect up those recyclables are not taxed either by the state or by the local.
So if I'm still having a little trouble hearing this, yep. But would you say that you then are in within this 3.9% that is on the chart that PCA gave us about composting? Is that, would that be in the range of where you are?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's hard to know because we don't have anything except what we measure, but we would probably be close to that 3.9%. And I'll try to get some additional numbers and see if we can supply that to you.
I think it would be helpful that if we all understood how much is actually composted in people's backyards. That's something I do, or our family does. And compost going into another waste stream, which a lot of families don't want to do, which is fine. And I think that's something we need to figure out a bit about, so when we are reporting, we understand that. Any other questions here? I don't see anybody. Thank you. Tony Cuelas, would you like to come up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I will be brief. It has been a long day this morning, as you have heard. We fought the weather this morning, not from Boston. Congratulations, by the way, for making it down. But a number of us to go over and listen to the container deposit presentation this morning on that cost-benefit analysis. But, again, thank you for allowing me to provide some comments today, and they would probably go to the extended producer responsibility as well as the container deposit you're about to hear about from Mr. Kadelka. And then I'll ask not a question, but point out a concern that I look forward to representing, talking to Representative Hornstein about.
Okay, let me just interject here. What we are going to do, since folks heard about those who are interested went to the bottling thing this morning, we're just going to hand out a summary so that everybody is on the same playing field. And then when PCA has finished their report, we're going to ask them to come back.
Completely understandable, Madam Chair.
We're not quite there yet.
But thank you today for allowing me to comment. You've had a rather robust discussion today on a lot of solid waste and recycling issues. As Mr. Gardner said, we moved a lot of cheese around today. And by most measurable standards, we are, whether you know, depending on how you look at the numbers, whether it's Washington, Oregon, or us, but we are a nation leader in our recycling programs, and we have invested millions, if not billions, of dollars in infrastructure to make us one of the nation's leaders. So that's why you hear that concern when we start moving things around, and I think you'll hear from Mr. Keegan later of the huge investment that his company has made based on what we've got going now in our infrastructure. So that's why we have some concerns in the business community when we start talking about changing some of the rules, if you will. We think it's a laudable goal to increase the recycling rates. We think a sensible, cost-effective manner is the way to approach it, utilizing the 3 R's, reduce, reusing, and recycling. And let me just give you 4 highlights very quickly, and I think that areas that we could look at. Number one, you've heard some discussion about single sort. You'll hear the PCA say that 70% of this state has that available, 30% doesn't. I think those numbers, when you look at them, jump off the chart, and that 30% that doesn't have single sort will include St. Paul when they come online. St. Cloud just went online. I think you heard Roseville is about to come online. And when you look at just the early numbers from St. Cloud when they started in August, and their latest numbers were 33% increase. I think Minneapolis was 62 or 63% on single sort. So I think that's an issue area that we should all look at. I know personally I live in Woodbury, and it is a huge success out that way. So that's something I think we should concentrate and focus on. Second of all, we've talked about in some of the reports you'll see, we're all, I think, pretty good at doing it at home, but it is the away from home that we need to focus on, whether it's at convenience stores or festivals or fairs that we all go to try and work on those, and that is an important component that I think we need to look at. If you look at the Recycling Association of Minnesota, has a very successful program called Message in a Bottle. That's, I think, very successful, and we should look at that. If you'll look at some of the convenience stores now, you'll see kind of the large plastic Coke bottles. I notice at a number of gas stations that I work at that are starting to become more frequent. And number three is there is an education component, I think, for businesses as well as us as residents that we need to look at. WasteWise has been working with Anoka, Ramsey, Washington, and Dakota County, and WasteWise is an affiliate of the Minnesota Chamber. And last year alone, just from their annual report, they helped 175 companies divert over a million pounds of waste from landfills. So I think we need to utilize things like that to go through in the education component. And finally, Madam Chair, the solid waste tax we've talked about ranging anywhere for the next projection of anywhere from $68 to $72 million. You heard the gentleman in front of me and Commissioner Reinhart talk about what the counties are spending, somewhere upwards of $40 million. We think that we should probably take a look at that money, and if we're having a stagnant recycling rate, maybe figure out why we're at a stagnant recycling rate, and if there's ways maybe we can better direct that, and we're willing to look forward and be look forward to participating in that discussion as it moves forward. Finally, in regards to Representative Hornstein's bill, there is the section that section one expands the definition of container requirements to commercial buildings, and then section three asks that source separated compostable materials, which are organics, for commercial and industrial in the metropolitan area. I think that's an area that I've got some questions about, and I look forward to working with Representative Hornstein as this bill, as he said, is a working draft, and so look forward to the conversations with him about that. And Madam Chair, with that, I'd stand for any questions.
Members, are there questions? I don't see any. Thanks so much. Stephen Smith. I am cognizant of the time, and members have trying to stay within 5 minutes, if you would. Members have been here for a long time.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Stephen Smith. I'm Vice President of Environmental and Regulatory Affairs for Verallia. We're a glass container manufacturer. I'm going to talk about the glass industry a little bit, and I'm also going to show you some numbers about how Minnesota is doing today and what Minnesota could do with the proposed legislation or the proposed MPCA draft that's out there. There are 48 container plants in 22 states in the United States. It's a $5.5 billion industry. We have 102 U.S. glass container furnaces producing approximately 30 billion containers in the United States. And we employ about 18,000 salaried and represented hourly workers in our plants, warehouses, and sales forces. And that includes the operation that's in Shakopee, Minnesota. We sell about 11,000 tons of glass containers, about 1.8 million tons of plastic beverage containers, about 1.5 million tons of aluminum containers, over 13 million tons, or about 200 billion containers of aluminum, plastic, and glass beverage containers throughout the United States. A little bit more on glass specifically. It can be recycled endlessly. There is no loss to it. The glass container that comes back to us has everything in it that we need. And over a ton of natural resources is saved for every ton that we recycle. Energy usage drops 2 to 3% for every 10% of glass that we use in our manufacturing processes. And it reduces NOx, SOx, and PM because the furnaces run cooler, and therefore the emissions are less. It's easier for us to meet our environmental goals. Over 6 tons of recycled glass remelted equals the reduction of 1 ton of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas, and that's become particularly important to us in some states like California. Washington State has been working on this, and some other states as well. Our commitment to sustainability, we buy every single ton we can get. We are one of, if not the largest buyer of recycled glass from the state of Minnesota today. And if we could get more from the state of Minnesota, we would buy more from the state of Minnesota. Most of the material coming through the state of Minnesota today is coming through single stream, and there's problems with single stream. Contamination's the most serious problem, and that's true not just for glass, but it's also true for aluminum and plastic. Because of that, we've created joint ventures for sorting on and off-site in Washington, Minnesota, and North Carolina. We've been active in supporting legislative change efforts. We believe that's necessary for a step change in recyclables from the municipal solid waste stream. We included some previous written testimony, that's posted on the NCPCA website, and we also included an article, Burying Treasure from Best Practices to Bad Ideas, and we would encourage you to review those. Every year in Minnesota, about 2.4 billion aluminum, glass, and plastic containers are landfilled in Minnesota, and as a commodity value, that's worth about $47 million. In the U.S., that figure is $117 billion, worth about $2.3 billion annually. The move to single stream typically improves recycling collection, but the recovery rates, what's actually recycled into something else, lags because of commingling. We talk about it in terms of having to unscramble the egg. Once it's all together, you've got to pull the individual parts off, and there's losses in that process. The squandering of valuable feedstock commodity continues while we debate competing recycling models. So this is the state of Minnesota and what it consumes in glass, plastic, and aluminum annually. About 3.4 billion containers altogether, 1.6 aluminum, 1.1 PET, and about 590 million glass. And this is what the current recycling rates look like. Shouldn't be misconstrued as not doing well. Minnesota is held as the gold standard or state of the art for single stream, and one of my jobs is to look at where our material comes from, and I study those states. I've studied Minnesota extensively, and this is state of the art for single stream. Minnesota has done a fine job putting those processes together and getting to the rates that you're at, and you should be very proud of that. One of the other things I do, I said I looked at where our material comes from. A large portion of our recycled material comes from 10 states. Over 65% comes from those 10 states. Overall, in the United States, about 33% of all glass is recovered. So one of the things I do typically is I look at where all this material is coming from in these states. All the bottle bills are different, and I look at what works and what doesn't work. One of the places I have studied is directly south of the state of Minnesota, and that's Iowa, and this is what their recycling rates look like. Iowa consumes about 1.9 billion. It's a smaller state in population, and it recycles about 1.4 billion. Aluminum, 900,000, and recycles 800,000. PET, you can see, is a little different. They consume about 645 million. And they recycle about 354 million. And that's because they passed their legislation 36 years ago, and that was before non-carbonated was popular. In today's world, states are having to go back to try to correct that, like New York and Oregon have passed that. We've been active in Iowa trying to help them get that legislation passed to include it in Iowa, and it has not occurred yet. This is where we buy the material from Iowa. We're the largest consumer of the glass that comes out of that state. Most of the glass, a high percentage of that glass, is shipped to Sepulpa, Oklahoma. We make it into beer bottles, and then the people in the United States are fine enough to open those back up and start the process again for us. But we also ship to Missouri. We have two facilities in Illinois, and we ship to Dunkirk. They're shipped that far because glass that comes through the bottle bill system has a real high purity value, and there's a lot of tons of it. And those two factors make it very valuable. One of the debates we've heard over the last 6 months is MRFs and how they perform with bottle bills. This is where the MRFs and recycling facility centers are located in the state of Iowa. This is right off the state DNR permitting report for those facilities. Most, if not all, of these facilities have been built since the bottle bill went into place. So those are facilities that were put in to make money while a bottle bill was in place. This is what Minnesota would look like if it passed the MPCA proposed draft. The rates, the overall beverage rate would still be $3.4 billion or so, but they'd recover $3.2 billion. So it would go from the red bar to the green bar. Aluminum would go up as well, PET would go up as well, and so would glass. And as a glass container manufacturer, we would be very, very interested in this. We would buy every single ton that the state of Minnesota could bring to the table. No changes in Minnesota over the next decade. Debating this issue means that about 24 billion aluminum, plastic, and glass containers are going to needlessly end up in the landfill, and it's going to be worth about $470 million as valuable commodity feedstock. Implementing the proposed bill in Minnesota would mean about 32 billion aluminum, plastic, and glass beverage containers will be recycled into new materials worth about $650 million to the communities, to the state, to the local and regional industries. A well-designed bottle bill can lead the way in recycling infrastructure. Minnesota's done a very good job putting that together. Improving recovery rates for more recyclables, there's no question that it would benefit in that regard in a very large way. It would facilitate improving single stream performance. We believe that bottle bills should work with single stream, and there's studies that are being released this afternoon in that regard. Buralia stands now active to participate in any dialogue to help that process to improve recovery. Thank you very much. I'll entertain any questions.
We are not going to be debating the bottle bill right now. It's just not, that is not our role right here. But if we certainly not going to cut off members' questions. Did you have a question? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Babian.
Could you refresh what you said about purchasing all of the recyclable materials that you possibly can from the state of Minnesota, glass and plastic?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representatives, we buy every ton of material we can for all of our furnaces. We simply cannot get the material today. Some of our facilities operate at 90%, and that would be those in the Northeast, in Massachusetts, that are in bottle bill states, surrounded by bottle bill states. We have other furnaces that operate at less than 5%. There are no bottle bill states close to those facilities. We buy every ton of cullet we can get our hands on. We simply can't get the material. If Minnesota introduced this bill and it passed and this became effective, it would introduce over 100,000 tons of material. We would actively go after all of that material. We would have to compete for that. We probably wouldn't get all of it, but we'd try to get all of it.
Thank you, Britt. Are you finished?
No.
One more question?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, then, to that point, I represent the furthest northwest corner of the state of Minnesota, and the Marquette recycling program that we have has ceased reclaiming or recycling glass because they say there's no market for it. So I would encourage you to pick up the phone and get a hold of us. We have glass available, but it's not being used.
Madam Chair, Representative, most of the time when I hear statements like that, it's the trimix they're referring to, not bottle bill material or material that's at that purity. Trimix doesn't carry much value to it, unfortunately, through a single stream because Grandma puts a plate in thinking she's recycling glass, and that's actually ceramic. It melts at a different temperature. So once it comes through a single stream process, it has to go to a beneficiator to be color sorted. And once it's color sorted, then we'd be interested in buying.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Yes. One other factor that I've seen in bottle bill states, I know if you spend as much time as I do in parks, well, not in weather like this, you'll also see people in Minneapolis going around on bikes or with bags sometimes, picking up discarded, I think, particularly aluminum cans, sometimes stealing them when recycling has been put out, which I think is a crime by our standards. If you go and even in places where there are deposits, people still will discard bottles and cans, particularly in parks and so forth. When you go see a homeless person in New York City carrying around a bag of cans and that he's collected from the park or something like that, you know that what he's carrying is a day's worth of food or maybe a week's worth of food or something like that. It's a very different market for the for items that have a deposit on them compared to things that are just valued by the weight of their aluminum.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Susan Collins? If you could keep your remarks within 5 minutes, I'd appreciate it.
I'll be briefer than that.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Susan Collins from the Container Recycling Institute. We're a 501c3 nonprofit environmental organization. We are a national research institute that focuses on policies that maximize the quantity and quality of packaging recycling. And today I just want to share a few facts with you about how recycling leads to job creation. Recycling creates more jobs than disposal. Ton for ton, recycling creates five to ten times as many jobs in collection, sorting, and transport than in garbage collection, hauling, and landfilling. And I'll give a couple of examples by commodity type that are pretty dramatic. These come from a report that we did in December 2011 called Returning to Work, Understanding the Domestic Jobs Impacts from Different Methods of Recycling Beverage Containers. So for glass, recycling creates 8.3 jobs per 1,000 tons processed versus only one-tenth of a job for producing that same glass from virgin material. The numbers are similarly dramatic for PET. It's 9.9 jobs for producing 1,000 tons of material from recycled content, meaning old bottles, versus 0.6 jobs for producing that same material from virgin resin. So meanwhile, I think you've heard this a few times today already, our glass and PET recyclers in the U.S. are hungry for more material, and the PET reclaimers are operating at only about 50% capacity on average. But a key to increased job growth is high-quality collection and sorting. Our study found that high-quality materials were far less likely to be exported to China, which means that these materials stayed in the U.S. and went on beyond the processing stage to produce high-quality, high-wage U.S. manufacturing jobs. In closing, also, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency just released a draft report last week that says a state-of-the-art beverage container recycling refund program would create a net of over 1,000 jobs in Minnesota. And that's all I have.
Thank you. You do bring up an interesting question about how much of our material is exported out of state, and I think we will ask PCA at some point for that kind of those numbers. I appreciate your bringing that up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify?
Madam Chair, very briefly, my name is Doug Carnival. I'm a branch of Carnival Law Firm representing the National Waste and Recycling Association that you may know as the National Solid Waste Management Association. We've changed our name and are now the National Waste and Recycling Association. I have with me Bill Keegan, who's our chapter chair here in Minnesota, and I have just a couple of brief comments about Representative Kornstein's bill, and Mr. Keegan was going to testify about the bottle bill, but we'll defer that testimony at your request for another time. He has a couple of comments about recycling, and together we'll take less than 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, with respect to Representative Hornstein's bill, there are some things in the bill that we support. Obviously, the idea of increased recycling is something that the recycling industry supports. Furthermore, we're in favor of more allocation of funds from the solid waste tax to go to recycling and other solid waste programs rather than their current repository, which is the general fund. So those concepts, we're looking forward to working with Representative Hornstein and show our support. I do have two comments about particular provisions in the bill that I want to make. One of which was not mentioned up until now, and I did want to mention it. That's Section 9, which talks about a rule change, and since we have just had this bill for a few days, we really hadn't had a chance to understand everything that's in here, so we're trying to figure out and understand what this rule change means and whether it's substantive and what impact it might have on this industry. So we'll be working with Representative Hornstein so that we can understand that provision along the way. The other provision has to do with Section 6 of the bill, which is something that that is of concern to us. This would raise the tax on waste that goes outside the metro area and is landfilled, adding a $6.66 a ton fee or tax to that waste. Those of you who have been here for some time remember that some years ago there were kind of a set of twin taxes or mirror taxes that were imposed, both of which were $6.66. One of them was the Greater Minnesota Landfill Cleanup Fee, and the second was the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust Fee, which is sometimes called MLCAT. Those are both $6.66. One of them applies to landfilling outside the metro area, and the comparable one applies to the $6.66 filling in the metropolitan area. So in our sense, we just question whether the plan here is to eliminate the outside the metro fee in lieu of this new fee, or whether this is going to be double taxation because there's already a $6.66 fee on landfilling outside the metro area, and that increase taxation by twice as much. If in fact it's not going to be a reduction of the current fee and elimination of it, obviously there's going to be resulting waste that is not going out of the metro area and stays in the metro area that's going to either need to be landfilled or handled at one of the processing facilities. And the question that we have is there capacity in the metro area to absorb that waste, or are going to we need to build additional waste energy facilities in the metro area to absorb the waste? So there's going to be an incentive to keep that waste in the metro area, and I'm not sure we have the capacity, nor has anyone thought about where that's going to go. Lastly, I just want to echo the comments that the Chamber of Commerce made. Since this is a new tax, and before we add a new tax, it seems to me that we ought to be taking a look at whether the current solid waste tax and the MLCAT fees are appropriately used, whether there's better ways to use those fees. We haven't had an audit, I understand, in 10 years, and we ought to take a look at how those are being allocated and whether we can use them better for recycling. And now Mr. Keegan has just a couple of comments.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Mr. Carnival said, my name is Bill Keegan. I'm the vice president of Demcon Companies. We're a small family-owned company that's been in the waste processing and business for over 50 years. We are currently the proud and now concerned owners of the newest MRF in the state of Minnesota. We just built a single-stream recycling facility that opened about a month ago. I am also the chair of the National Waste and Recycling Association, the former NSWMA, and we represent over 800 private sector companies throughout the United States. I just wanted to make general comments on recycling and our existing system. We have a very successful, as you've heard in previous testimony, a very successful recycling program in Minnesota. I believe we're third or fourth in the nation. We have the cleanest material of those facilities that are doing the single stream recycling in Minnesota. We have the cleanest material nationwide, so we have a very successful program. And part of this is because of the innovation that the current system drives. Innovation and investment from companies like ours. You know, we've spent millions of dollars investing in what we believe to be a system that's going to advance and increase recycling for this state. It fosters good public-private relationships. We've got good relationships with our customers and with municipalities. There's refunds that go back to the municipalities that help foster those relationships. The current single-stream system that we've seen implemented increases recycling anywhere from 30% to 50% in the communities as it's rolled out. It's only been rolled out about 60% of the communities in the state. So the program is still being implemented, and I think we need to allow time for that to be implemented throughout the whole state and see what effects that has. That 30 to 50% increase that you see when you switch to single stream recycling in large part is due to the convenience factor. We as a public generally are, forgive me for being a little blunt, but a little lazy. We like to put everything in one bin and roll it to the corner and it gets picked up. That has been truly the success of that recycling program and moving to one sort or no sort recycling. We are able to take pride when we roll our carts to the curb and the recycling bin is full and the trash bin is not, or it's half full. So I think that brings success to that program. My concerns are any changes to that system that would undermine existing infrastructure, such as facilities as ours, and undermine the system that we have now that we believe is very successful. Are we doing enough? I don't think so. I think we need to do more. We need to increase that recycling rate. I think there's ideas we can implement, some of which would be maybe mandating commercial and residential recycling. Well, as I mentioned previously, having the single sort system roll out so that other 40% of the communities that don't currently have it. We could look at maybe bans for recyclable materials in the garbage at the point of generation for wherever those recyclables are generated, being not allowed to go in the trash. Continue to innovate and invest in the current system and continue to educate our public on what can and can't go in there and increase our recycling efforts. So with that, I'll wrap up, and I thank you very much for your time on this.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Okay. We are going to, I don't see anyone else who would like to testify. We're just going to hand out the summary sheet. I believe this is a part of the summary of the bottle bill. Work that you have done. Did you want to make any comments about this at this point, or just give this to us for digestion?
Chair and committee members, I'd like to just make a minute just to say what it is and what it is not and what.
Okay, that would be helpful.
So what you have in your hands is a part of the larger MPCA beverage container report we're asked to do for the legislature due January 15th. There are three parts of that legislation. One is to put together a proposal, straw proposal on what a beverage container program would look like, do a cost-benefit analysis is the second part, and the third part is get feedback. This is the cost-benefit analysis that we had a third party take care of. This is only parts of it. It has the executive summary, the first two parts of the report that explain what the straw proposal we had them look at was, and then the last two, which just highlight some summary of cost and benefits and impacts on various stakeholders. The full report is on our website. I mentioned the January 15th deadline. We've informed the chairs and the minority leads that we will not be meeting that date. We have more work to do. We have held one public meeting early on when we started working on the straw proposal before it went to the cost-benefit analysis effort, and that included written comments to us. We've got the cost-benefit analysis done. We had a public meeting of interested folks today where we had the author of that go through it, got some feedback. We have a written comment request for a week out to the agency. And once we have all that information, we will be making a final report.
Super. Thank you. I don't see any other questions. I would very much like to thank Mary Faust for working with us today. We had a crowd, and I appreciate everybody coming. Would like to hear from you by email if you have additional comments you would like to make, because this is the overall issue is one that we are going to be having to grapple with. So, 9 o'clock tomorrow, members. Look forward to seeing you then. With that, this meeting is adjourned.